1237 Center Chaudray. Not sure what we have here today. Senator Pappas moves adoption of the division report. Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, this is one of those situations where the Senate the committee and the division worked on the Senate file 1110. But after they finished their work and their delete everything division report, the House file came over. So what we have in the committee is the House file. You should have in your folders the delete everything amendment to Senate file 1110. And I think what you want to do is take that delete everything amendment and make it to the House file.
I'll make that motion.
All right. Senator Pappas' motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Chaudray.
This is the omnibus environment policy bill. It also includes an article which we added, which is the omnibus game and fish bill. We did that in anticipation of kind of House file, Senate file matching issues, but it is identical. The article, the game and fish article in this House file, is identical to Senate file 1116, which is also on the agenda. I don't know if Mr. Mossman would like to explain the financial part of the bill. I believe everything is square with it as discussed in division, but certainly your committee can discuss that.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
Senator Chaudray, what did you say about 1116 is also on the agenda? It sounds like we didn't pass the game and fish bill on the Senate floor?
No.
Oh, it must be the House.
Yeah, that was just the House.
Ms. Johnson, did you want to comment on the fiscal note?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, what you have in your packets for the fiscal note is a one-page summary cover sheet that Mr. Mueller put together for the two articles, and I'll walk through that. Attached to that is the full fiscal notes for Senate file 1110 and Senate file 1116 were much longer than this, but many of the agencies responded that they had no fiscal impact, so we just took the pieces of those two fiscal notes that had costs and descriptions that were in the bill and attached those pieces to the one-page summary on the front. So walking through the one-page summary, Article 1 has a provision related to multiple vehicle permits for state parks, and there will be a $5,000 revenue loss in the parks account in the Natural Resources Fund. There's a couple ATV forfeiture, or there are ATV forfeiture provisions, one which will have a $50,000 cost in fiscal 10 and 11, and then also related to those provisions, there's a $3,000 revenues that will start coming in fiscal 2011. That's activity in the special revenue fund. Then moving to Article 2, the game and fish provisions, all of the amounts in this article relate to impacts on the game and fish fund. The free fishing for persons 90 and over has a revenue loss for license issuances of $7,000 in 10 and $14,000 in fiscal 11. Section 16 has some provisions related to free commercial fishing licenses under 16. $5,000 expense to set up that program one time. Then dropping down to the lifetime spearing licenses, also $5,000 cost, and then a couple items with some revenue loss for non-resident spear licensing and non-resident fish. And dark houses, $31,000 for the first provision, the spearing licenses in fiscal 10. Sorry, those would be revenue gains, and $69,000 in fiscal 11. For the fish houses, $17,000 in revenue in 10, $37,011. And then the fishing contest fee adjustments has a small expense of $19,000, and then revenues, a revenue loss of $13,000 and $29,010.11.
Okay, thank you. Senator Chaudhry, any?
Nope. Mr. Chair, this is a bill passed the Environment Policy Committee, passed the Environment Finance Division, and is it amended as per the desires of those committee members.
Okay. Senator Vickerman.
I have an amendment to 825.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brickman.
Chair and members of the committee, the 825 amendment just simply allows for planning and development on the Casey Jones Trail and also on the Des Moines River Trail. It's already passed our division, passed it, but the House wasn't able to move it ahead with no money, just a lot, and they've already agreed to plan. So that's my last hope of getting it planned.
Senator Chaudhry?
Senator Vickerman spoke to me about this amendment beforehand. It's fine.
Okay. Senator Vickerman has moved the 825 amendment. Is there further discussion on the amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed. Motion carries. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, there's one section in this bill that I don't really believe that needs to be in there, and it's Article 1, Section 42, it starts on page 28. Mr. Chairman and members, this deals with the critical habitat license plate, and it adds a reference to a one-ton pickup truck, and, you know, it already says passenger automobile or recreational vehicle, and the one-ton pickup truck's encapsulated in that first reference. So I would move that we move Section 44. Does it need to be in there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy consulted with me on this beforehand, and we consulted with the DNR, and Senator Murphy's motion does not appear to be a problem.
Right, we have Senator Murphy's amendment to delete Section 42. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, we'll make sure we consult with you on any future license plate things that come up, as small as they might be.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Chaudhry, is there anything else in, well, there are lots of things in the bill. Can you just tell me a little bit more about Section 5? Was glancing at it, the off-highway vehicle criminal penalties?
Yes. Mr. Chair, this is a provision that has passed all the relevant committees, and for the first time in my recollection, although I've only been here 12 years, that the environmental groups, ATV groups, and the DNR have agreed on a proposal regarding ATVs. What it does is address the try to impose consequences on the worst of the worst ATV riders that we believe are giving the sport a bad name. It creates a new standard of violation for recklessly damaging a wetland, and then imposes the possibility of forfeiture on the second offense of that new provision.
Senator Higgins.
Chair, Senator Chaudhry, am I just forgetting, or did this come through the Public Safety Division, where misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors are supposed to go?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, it went through Senator Moy's committee, if you recall. And then I'm trying to recall if it went through yours as well. And perhaps Mr. Knopf can recall. It may not have.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Yeah.
So I just did a quick flip through the, Mr. Chair, the fiscal notes, and I don't see anything related to a fiscal effect on these criminal penalties. The Department of Corrections or somebody should have had. Even if it just comes back as criminal, we should know. But if there are rampant craziness going on out there, there would be an effect on my budget.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, we absolutely do not believe that to be the case. DNR predicts forfeitures of not more than five, probably just one a year. That was what we were basing this off of. And so really we're there's some startup administrative costs which the users of ATVs are paying for. And then I'll have Mr. Knopf explain the fiscal note as it pertains to this division or this portion.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, this bill, the complete fiscal note, which you don't have, did include something from public safety that shows nothing. I don't see anything in the department. It's got the Supreme Court and public safety, but I don't see the Department of Corrections on here. But Mr. Mueller noted on the front all the agencies that came back with any kind of a fiscal impact from this bill, and they didn't list anything.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, just from my recollection on the crime committee in the past, corrections would be impacted if it's a felony. Is that correct? Or
could be the gross misdemeanor.
I see. Okay. That our assumption was because of a gross misdemeanor, it would remain at the local level.
There would be, the courts would be impacted. I think they're here. The Supreme Court has weighed in on it. So, it's just good to check.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, to supplement what Mr. Knopf said, if you look at page 1 of 4 on the attached fiscal note, you can, the agencies are all listed there, so you can see that they all reported in. We just didn't copy all of the pages here because they said no fiscal note for the Supreme Court and Public Safety Department. So that's that page, though, is the summary page for the entire fiscal note. There on page 1.
Senator Higgins, it's possible that was my mistake, the extent that there was this bill and another bill that came to the Finance Committee in April, by April 13th, 14th. And obviously these are predominantly environmental bills, so obviously went immediately to Senator Anderson's division. And Senator Anderson, I think you finished working on it 2 or 3 days ago.
Midnight on the
10th. On this bill?
Yeah.
Was that yesterday or the day before? Just very recent, just this week, Mr. Chair. We just haven't had time.
So, Senator Higgins, we probably should have touched base with you either during the time, well, I'm not sure during the time the bill was in Senator Anderson's division, but certainly in the last day or two, we should have checked on that to see if you wanted the bill. So, the expectation is that this will be the last committee hearing for the session. And so, we're trying to schedule these last several bills. So I apologize if we did not catch that in Senate, this particular section. And
Mr. Chair, you know, it might have been reasonable to expect that it go to Senator Foley's division as well for the Supreme Court. And, you know, we might have just looked at it and kicked it out and said, no, it's okay, we don't need to hear it. You kind of don't expect misdemeanors and bills, misdemeanors and bills. So.
And, Mr. Chair, yeah, and we normally would have, we just didn't catch that either, because we would have easily, commonly referred it to the other divisions as well, and just didn't kick in that that was necessary.
Well, it, although it
allows take responsibility for that.
You know, but,
it's fine.
But it does make the point that we should be a little bit careful. In fact, they just look at the division report, which was signed on May 12th, so you know, a couple of days ago. And when we get these omnibus bills, and this bill is 53 pages, and we're talking about a single section out of the bill that's less than a page, certainly for policy committee chairs and Senator Chaudhry, you're here in that capacity, we should be careful when these omnibus bills to review them and make sure we get them to the Finance Committee early enough so if they have to go from division to division, even if, say, Senator Higgins and Senator Foley, if in your case it's going to be a very quick hearing, maybe even you know, start in your division first when you've got you know, time to hear a bunch of, for your purposes, smaller bills. So we should be careful about that. And to the division chairs, when you get the omnibus bills in your division, as those of you who don't have policy within your division, should be careful to not just assume that it's within its entirety in your division. So it's a lesson that we should remember for next time around. So, Sarah Stump.
I have some. We had a good discussion in the policy committee on this provision, but I still have some apprehension about how this is all going to work. And I think the concerns I have relate to how it's going to be enforced. Wetlands are all over the place. I mean, you have different classes of wetlands. And the other thing is how do you determine the extent of damage done by one versus maybe whether it was done by somebody else. So I'm sure that the enforcement part is going to be the key to this, so that we don't end up having some energetic person out there that sees some damage and sees a person riding an ATV and connects the two, even though there may not be a connection. Or maybe some connection, and we have if that happens throughout the area or throughout northern Minnesota, there'll be a minor revolution because and you're an ATV rider, so I think it's a venture down a new road in terms of how we try to address a very serious issue, but I am concerned about it. So I just want to voice it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, your concern is why we created this new higher standard. Significant discussion went into this enforcement piece over the interim in the working group that created this, or went into the information and that came out of the working group that led to this proposal. And the same concern was raised. The current standard is that for a wetland violation is to carelessly damage a wetland. that standard is actually pretty high too, because it's not just damaging, it's it has to be a real damage, it has to be shown, and it has to be shown that it was truly a careless act. And even under the current standard, there's not more than 15 violations or citations as of last year. In 2008, there were no more than 15 of those violations. This creates a higher standard yet for a reckless damage of a wetland. So, and in judicial terms and legalese, that's really an intentional act. And that's who we're aiming this bill at now, is the worst of the worst, who not only have clearly gone in and damaged a wetland intentionally, riding around in circles, just creating a melee, but then also there has to be damage as well. So you're concerned about, well, what if you drive into what is technically a wetland and it's dry? Even if that's reckless, there still has to be actual damage to the wetland. So we really went through this verbiage thoroughly in creating this new standard. And I should also reiterate that it's only the second offense of that new higher standard that would lead to the forfeiture. So it's really aimed at the worst of the worst. And the riders really want something in place that provides a deterrent to the people who are giving the responsible riders a bad name. And we came up with this as a reasonable step forward. And the DNR actually predicts maybe one forfeiture a year. And we feel that that's enough of a step to get the word out to people that they need to stay on the trail.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Foley.
I call your attention to the fiscal note on page 3 of 14. And about in the middle of the page, there's some language dealing with gross misdemeanor versus misdemeanor, where it says it will have no impact on the bill. And the tracking system for the courts, I really would like to know more about what that is. And first of all, I don't see any money flowing from DNR to our vision. And the same with the others. I'd like to know where the tracking systems are. And have your folks go to those locations?
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, this was also a source of great discussion over the interim on what the DNR's enforcement system is, tracking system is. It's actually it's an issue we're going to have to address holistically in the future, because it's separate to a degree from the rest of our enforcement activities. DNR has its own system, so to speak. It connects up with the other enforcement systems somewhat.
But this whole thing, Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, clearly indicates a need for review by division Senator Higgins' vision to give us some kind of idea as to what's going where and what the impacts are.
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, we've examined those. The enforcement is only within the enforcement aspect is only within the DNR, and the fines, as you read here, go to the courts, and the updates on the forms for forfeiture are going to be paid for by the DNR. In fact, the funds they're getting are from the user accounts. There's really minimal, if any, impact on the actual judiciary with regards to this, particularly given that there are only 15, no more than 15 of these citations under the old standard last year alone. This creates a higher standard. We expect even less. So, I mean, it's really minor at best.
Mr. Chairman.
There's no, not going to be any flood of new forfeitures of ATVs because of these wetland violations.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Chaudhry, I appreciate what you're saying, but the fact is that it merely illustrates what Senator Higgins and I have both indicated, that we need to be kept in a loop and to make certain that the criminal penalties are tracked and handled so we can look at whatever the impact that it's having on the criminal justice system. Well, obviously, by your own statements, you've indicated a need for doing that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, the only thing I would add to the previous discussion is that this passed the Senator Moore's Judiciary Committee. There was a discussion about these penalties, so this provision is not a surprise to folks on your in your categories. And I think if there was an impact, a real impact for you to need to review it, it could have you could have been alerted at that time.
Further questions for Senator Chaudhry? Further discussion? Any motions or anybody want to do anything?
Yeah. Move the bill.
I'll move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay.
Right. Mr. Chair, I'll move that Senate File 1110 is amended be recommended to pass.
Okay.
It's a House file now.
House file.
House file 1237.
Okay, Senator Anderson moves that House File 1237 as amended be recommended to pass. For the discussion, if not all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Chaudhry.
And Mr. Chair, Senate File 1116 is a mirror image of Article, the Game and Fish Article 2 of the previous bill. If we could pass that out as well, I'd appreciate it.
We don't have that in front of us.
I thought it was. Oh, okay. We're good to go then.
Okay. All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair members.
All right.
Mr. Chair
next
members.
We have House File 925, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 925, which is the companion to my Senate File 1368, asks that the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development to collect and analyze and report unemployment data that's a little bit more thorough than the traditional measure that we currently use to gauge and assess our level of unemployment in the state of Minnesota. Currently, the measure that we talk about a lot and are familiar with, that we hear about in the news reports on a seemingly daily basis, is what they call the U3 measure, which is really a measure of folks who have more recently become unemployed and have filed for unemployment benefits. And it misses kind of the larger measure of folks who are either marginally attached to employment or have become completely detached. That's what they call the U6 measure. So this bill gives the commissioner the authority and the responsibility to also take that measure and report it at the same time that they're reporting the more traditional measure. It doesn't replace the traditional measure. It just simply gives us a little bit more, a slightly fuller picture of unemployment in Minnesota. The federal government and more states are trying to take a snapshot of both of those on a regular basis. The reason we're here, Mr. Chair, is because it turns out we actually have to pay for this bill. It's going to cost about $100,000 to do this, and We got an amendment over from the, or got the bill over from the House, and they're paying for it in a way that, that they really can't pay for it, and so we found a way that they can pay for it, which is to authorize the use of some administrative dollars in the unemployment insurance fund. Additionally, the agency thinks by doing this work, this is a reimbursable expense from the federal government that also will probably be part of the mix. So we're here, Mr. Chair, to identify the right source of funds. That's the A50 amendment.
Mr. Chairman,
Sarah Pappas.
I'll move the A50 amendment.
Okay. And Mr. Mossman, Sarah DeBlanca, they're looking for the right source of funds. Mm-hmm. Is that your understanding relative to the amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, yes. This has been worked out with the Department of Employment and Economic Development, who is here. And this addresses, and it, you'll note that there's some uncertainty because the amount of money in this source fluctuates, but the language is written permissively that it's up to this amount from this funding source.
Okay. We have Senator Pappas' motion on the, has the A50 amendment been distributed?
Yes.
Okay. We have Senator Pappas' motion on the A50 amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Further discussion on the bill?
Then, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
We're working out the House file, right, 925?
Right.
So then on page 4, is there a delete of section 3?
Mr. Chair, that.
Senator Pappas, this bill's procedure through the Senate was a little bit different from the last one in that it was up on the floor at the time, the Senate file, 1368, was on the floor at the time the House file came over.
Mm-hmm.
So it was amended under Rule 45 to substitute the Senate language.
Okay.
And then it was stricken and sent down here. So the language that we're working on is the language in 1368. That's why it does fit into 1368 on page 4 after line 1.
Okay. I got you. I don't have 1368.
Yeah, I think 1368 is in your package.
Okay. I got it. Okay. Then, Mr. Chairman, I would move that House File 925, as amended, be recommended to pass. Are we ready for that motion?
I don't know. We'll see how it happens.
All right.
We have Senator Pappas' motion that House File 925 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Pappas, we were ready for the motion.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we have Senator Torres Ray, Senate File 1797. And there's no division report on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. Senate File 1797 is a bill that will instruct the State Advisory Council on Early Childhood Education to create an inventory of early childhood services. And, members, this is a very simple bill, but I hope it is an instrument that could really help us understand some of the fragmentation that exists today in early childhood education. And my hope is that with this instrument, we will be able to really look at some of the gaps that we currently have, some of the work that is being done today, and how we could expand some of the good work that takes place in early childhood education. Those members who are in the different education committees, health committees, and human services committees know that we have different provisions and different offices that administer funding for early childhood education, and they don't necessarily connect or do the work with one another. And so the intent here is really to create a very simple instrument that will give the legislature an opportunity to see kind of a map of how these systems actually work. New Mexico did this. It was a governor's order, and it's a very simple instrument. I will be happy to show it to you, but it's just simply a chart that says, it describes, it gives the title of the program, the money that is being allocated to the program, and a very short description. And I have a little bit of a problem with respect to the fiscal note, and I am going to ask Senator Stumpf if he could help me with this. The allocation for this was possible because the Education Committee really thought that there was a lot of value into this. Originally, this bill did not have an appropriation, and we had a hearing in the Education Finance Committee. I received support, bipartisan support by the committee. An appropriation was put into this work, but it was part of the allowances for early childhood education that was part of the omnibus bill, and we lost that, I understand, during conference committee. So I do not know now what is the status of this provision for this particular bill. And I think if I am not, if I'm correct, Senator Stumpf, the appropriation was about $10,000 or $12,000. I am not exactly sure. And Mr. Nauman is here, too. If he could explain that to us, that would be very helpful.
Mr. Chair and members, in division, the inventory the bill has a cross-reference to the State Advisory Council on Early Childhood Education and Care. The council had funding for fiscal year 09, but did not have funding beyond that. This creates an additional burden upon the council, and the division paid for that burden with a cross-reference to a provision that was paid for out of the Senate position on the K-12 bill for the early childhood education allowances. As Senator Torres-Ray made reference to, that position was not sustained in the conference committee. So in a sense, the final position of this bill is that it's unpaid for the burdens upon the council. Theoretically, this committee could delete Section 1 and allow that burden to be borne by the council without funding. The current law continues. Seek another alternative.
Well, I'm not sure where that leaves us.
Mr. Chair and members, the permanent law on the council does provide language that the council may pursue additional funds from state, federal, and private sources. You can see that on lines 1.13 through 1.16.
Sir.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we've been doing a lot this year to the extent funds are available or if, additional funds like in current law can be pursued. So I think we could always add that kind of language to this. And who knows, maybe we might still get the child care allowances funded by some miracle this year. It's certainly important to do that.
Sarah Stone.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Pappas raises a good point. The E-12 education bill is still kind of in play. I mean, we don't know exactly what's going to happen. And I think one of the suggestions that Mr. Allen mentioned would be to get a Senate position back out the state appropriation language right now, leave federal and private, and then we could move the bill to the floor so we could get a Senate position on it. And then if the E-12 education bill reopens, then we could adjust that back in the state appropriation.
So, Sarah Pappas, are you suggesting the language then?
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair, I'm endeavoring to do that as we speak. I suppose one possibility, I'm just doing this quickly, would be to delete an amount on 1.8, or strike that. strike from pre-kindergarten on line 1.1, strike the new language on 1.11. I'm sorry, on 1.10, strike pre-kindergarten. On 1.11, strike the new language and insert what I think works. The State Advisory Council on Early Childhood Education and Care may pursue additional funds from state, federal, and private sources. And I haven't completed the sentence. I apologize.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Watson?
Yes,
and
my
intent
is to get rid of the rest of that.
Rather than be amending the statute to take care of a short-term problem, you might want to think about adding a new subdivision 3 on the last page, subdivision 3 appropriation. Any federal or private money received by the council for this purpose is appropriated to the council.
Yep. That's better.
If they get the money, they can spend the money.
Then, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Watson, do you make any changes in Section 1, Subdivision 3?
Or
it's deleted. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Senator Pappas?
I'll move that.
The only issue
okay.
is that
Senator Pappas moved the language as proposed by Senate Counsel. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All right. Opposed. Motion carries.
Can I make one question? Raise one question about page 2, line 11. It says the inventory should be updated every biennium. And normally, don't you should? You say must or may.
Why don't you say may?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator Frederickson, I think that is a friendly amendment.
Page 2, line 11, I would move to delete should. That word should and insert may.
And on that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Okay, Senator Stump moves on Senate File 1797 as amended to recommend the pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Okay, Senator Scobin. Senate File 1123. And members, Senator Scolin, we had the bill adopted to the division report previously, and so we're bringing the bill back in front of us. So, Senator Scolin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and thank you for the continuance from the other day, too. It gave Senator Latz a little opportunity to check on that letter from the federal government. And so what you have before you today is the annual lands bill. This normally carries provisions that clean up a lot of the technical problems with state lands, state land administration, and state land sales. And most of them are pretty technical in nature. There are a couple that carry a little money on them, and we'll have that discussion.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, we already adopted the committee report.
Yes.
Okay, I'll move the bill then.
Okay, Sarah Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what you want to. I apologize, I missed the first minute of this, so I'm not sure.
I just sat down, Sarah.
Okay, I didn't miss anything. We had some discussion about this letter from the DNR, and Senator Scogin was going to try to check on whether there was a real threat or not, but the letter from the Department of the Interior says that we could be, if we do sell this particular land in whatever, which section are we? I need to find the section.
I believe it's Article 2, Section 8, page 21, line 29, if I'm looking.
You believe that?
Just off the top of your head. Section 8.
Not that this one has been talked about in any other committee.
No, not that you've been thinking about it at all in the last few
Mr. Chair and members, Senator Latz has actually done most of the work on this, and that's why when he wasn't here the other day, I asked for the continuation. He made the call to the federal government after receiving their letter. And, you know, in, for full disclosure, we do now have a letter from the county commissioners, from the DNR, from the state of Minnesota, and from the federal government that would like us to not do this. I mean, I need to be perfectly honest with you. Senator Latz would like to continue to work on this and leave it in the bill. He wasn't able to be here this morning. I think that the federal government basically has told us that they have their name on the deed on this property because of the pool of money that the money was taken out of to purchase this land. And they have not threatened us, but indicated that if they eventually rule that the money was not used properly, which could occur if it is sold back to a private individual, that the state of Minnesota may be in line to lose up to $17 million in grant money. That would be devastating. However, I believe that there is some negotiating that could occur, and that I am pretty confident that we would not lose $17 million, and Senator Latz would be willing to do some of those negotiations, but that's all speculation on our part because we haven't gone through this process before.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that that detailed explanation from Senator Scogin, and everything he said is correct, and we've spent a lot of time debating the merits of this in the various committees, but this issue about the loss of federal funds hadn't really come up until the bill came to the full finance committee. And, you know, I've been trying to sort of stay neutral on the issue more or less. And we have very different points of view from different senators. Senator Saxhog and Olson are very opposed to this land sale because their counties
add my name to it.
Their counties are very opposed to it and are on record against it. As Senator Scogin said, Senator Latz and Senator Scogin have been trying to facilitate the sale in order to, you know, correct some perceived wrongs from the past. But to me, and that's why I sort of don't want to get in the middle of it, because there's a lot of, you know, good arguments on both sides, and it's a complex issue. It's hard to determine who's really right here. But the issue of losing federal dollars, I think, is an issue that we do need to think about in this committee, and has, to me, it's elevated the concern that I have about this. And I think, you know, what I'm told is that the House is ready to accept this position in conference committee if we pass it. And so, yes, there could be some negotiating going on, but I'm not sure that we should proceed with the bill with this in it, with Section 8 in it. I just think it might be irresponsible for us to do that if there is a possibility of jeopardizing millions of dollars of federal funds. And, you know, I'm not sure that this would need to happen this year. We can continue to negotiate and have that discussion. So, Mr. Chair, I guess my, I feel that I need to move to delete Section 8.
Mr. Chairman, I would withdraw my motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, then I can make my motion more appropriately. So, Mr. Chair, I move to delete Section 8, Article 2, Section 8, page 21, line 27. Starting.
Yes.
Senator Scogin?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, this is the fifth stop for this bill. And I will oppose the amendment.
Sir Ferguson.
It would seem to me that Senator Latz and the individual like to buy this property could continue to work on this and maybe make out a friendly agreement with the Department of Natural Resources, if that's possible, to arrive at an agreement where they could buy the property without this being in the bill. That could pursuit either way, whether or not this is in the bill. And if it's not in the bill, they've got a year or more to work on seeing if they could free up the land from the federal government's concern.
Senator Anderson, your motion was to delete.
Yes.
Here's my problem. I put 80 acres into crap, and I put it in when land wasn't that high. I put it for you know, maybe I ought to take mine out of there because I can sell it for $5,000 a day instead of the two that I got when I put it in there. So you got to be careful when you start the process. I knew fully well what I was doing when I made it perpetual. So I am not going to support doing it.
Yeah, Sarah Betzel.
Okay. I know Senator Mary Olson is here. I think this might be in her area while she's here. I'm kind of curious as to what her position may be on this.
Sir Olson,
I don't think she's doing the county's bill.
Well, it could be a pension bill.
Well, my bill, yeah.
Sir Olson, did you wish to make a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just to make sure that the record is clear on this point, the letter from the Department of the Interior says that they believe, if enacted into law, this bill would represent a violation of the state's assent legislation requirements and federal laws and regulations. And so it says that they would proceed to have Minnesota being designated as being in diversion. And once that designation becomes final, Minnesota will become ineligible to participate in the SFR program and will lose approximately $15 million in annual funding. So it's not a one-time loss, it's an annual loss. And then it goes on to say for hatcheries and the things that this money is used for. And so, Mr. Chair, I won't go back into the merits of this, only to say that the first time my counties had an opportunity to weigh on this with resolutions against it, as well as the Watershed District, the Township, the Lake Association, and others who live on this lake and are concerned about this habitat and use this as public property, we were already in finance, you know, where there really wasn't an opportunity for that full discussion. I know that DNR had weighed in on that discussion earlier, but I do think that Senator Anderson is correct when she says that the loss of these funds also puts a whole new light on what this would do. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to vote for the Anderson motion. Not so much about the loss of federal funds and, you know, the feds trying to tell us how to manage our property or anything, but mainly because, you know, these individual issues sometimes get here, and the best thing to do is to leave them in the circle file. You know, we only make matters worse when we try to pass legislation to help, you know, these individual projects move forward, especially when there are so many people that are against it and so few that are for it. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be supporting Senator Anderson's motion.
Mr. Chair, if I might, if we, you know, a compromise might be to change that required sale date to upon approval from the federal government, that the sale would move forward.
That takes away the authority that we have in this committee. I'm worried about the whole project should be in. We visited that 10 miles. We've done that. Let's go there. All that does is gives another opening. I'm going to be out of here on the 19th of May, and I'm not going to have time to turn around and do this. So I think we ought to act on Senator Anderson's motion that gets deleted from it.
You know, it would be Senator Scogin, you mentioned that Senator Lass has been involved with this and he's not available. The difficulty we have is this is probably it in terms of hearing the bill. And with or without Senator Lass, whether we approve Senator Anderson's motion or not, if we're going to take action on the bill, we probably need to do it at this point.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, there's, you know, we could spend, when I'm sure you don't want to spend a couple hours debating the merits of whether family, the heirs of the family that formerly owned this land, I think in the 1970s, should be allowed to purchase it, or whether the DNR should be allowed to keep it in the use for which they're trying to use it. There's a lot of argument back and forth about which is a better use of the land and who's got a better, you know, entitlement to use that land. That's really more of a policy question. And as I said, that we've gone back and forth and had a variety of votes on that and long testimony on those issues in the policy committee. And Senator Lass has a constituent who's an heir to the family that used to own the land who wants to purchase it. And but I think in the finance committee, the reason I'm moving this is not because I really want to take sides on that policy question, but because we're threatened with the loss of significant federal dollars. And I think that is an issue that belongs here, and I think for that reason, we should move to take this out, even though there can be continuing discussions about, you know, maybe there's a resolution to the policy questions once we, if there's a resolution to the federal funding. But that seems like a reason why we should take this section out.
Mr. Chair, I just point out that I believe even if Senator Latz wanted to try to run this on its own, because it borders public waters and it's owned by the DNR, that it would have to come through the lands bill eventually anyway. I think if I'm understanding that right. So I don't know that he can do it on his own. I think it would have to be with the lands bill.
Sir Olson.
Do we just do that once a biennium or once every year? Might there be a lands bill next year?
I think there, if there's enough pieces, you know, yeah.
Chair, this was a bill that's introduced. It's alive for next year. It's hard for me to envision getting an agreement with the federal government in 3 days or whatever we have left. Nothing moves that quickly. But it would be nice if some of those things were cleared up that might make both the policy and the fiscal aspect of it clearer.
Well,
and
in this,
I don't know if there's a sense of, you know, obviously we're investing a lot of energy into it right now. Whether it would, if it's worthy of being pursued next year, they continue. We're all more knowledgeable. We should have more information even by that time.
Well, and this committee doesn't want to deal with the policy, so
right.
I get that.
Sir Federici.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just reiterate what I said before. I support Senator Anderson's motion, and Senator Latz and the individual can pursue this without this being in the bill. They can continue discussing with the federal government about more details, maybe try to come to an agreement with the Department of Natural Resources, maybe where there could be some swapping of land or some other alternative that would satisfy everybody's needs. But I don't want to jeopardize the federal funds. And I believe, if my memory's correct, those are funds that come from sportsmen in Minnesota buying fishing and hunting equipment, and that's directed back to Minnesota for use from our natural resource area. I don't think it's a threat from losing those money.
Okay. We have Senator Anderson's motion in front of us. Is there further discussion on Senator Anderson's motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the bill's amendment.
Okay, we have a couple questions. Mr. Mossman, just check with Mr. Mueller on something before we vote. Any further discussion on the bill? Okay, then I need to hold up for a second. I could suggest we'd go to your bill, but hopefully
it might take a little longer.
Have a quick resolution. You and Senator Thomasoni have worked this out, right?
Mr. Chairman, this is what I can say about this seatbelt legislation over the past few years. I've gotten to Senator Thomasoni. He came up to me yesterday and he said, I had a dream that I got pulled over by the State Patrol and I wasn't wearing my seatbelt.
The dream was that I didn't have my seatbelt on and I was at a stop sign. And there was
police when he's behind me, and I made sure I made a complete stop and didn't put my blinker on, so I didn't get picked up.
I'm getting to it. And pretty soon you're going to have nightmares. Just squads of state patrolmen following you wherever you go.
Is he going to change his vote?
We can arrange that too, right, Chief?
Is he changing his vote then?
See?
Are you changing your vote?
No.
Okay, members, we cleared up the question we had. All right, so is there further discussion? I think Senator Murphy moved that Senate File 1123.
No, the amendment.
We passed the amendment. Further discussion, further amendments? If not, Senator Murphy moves that Senate File 1123, as amended, be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, members.
We lighten your load for you.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
Two division reports.
Next, we have Senator Murphy. Senate File 42. Okay. Senator Murphy moves adoption of the Transportation Division report.
Well, wait a minute, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, there's two division reports, one for transportation and one from Senator Foley's committee, right?
Yes. Yes.
Right. Which one are we working on, Mr. Chairman? The one coming out of transportation?
Mr. Watson?
Okay, that's fine.
All right, so Senator Murphy moves adoption of the Transportation Division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, then I would move to reject the referral from the Judiciary Budget Division, the committee report from Judiciary.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, as I recall the discussion, we had an unusually effective date of June 9, 2009. And as I recall in the discussion, that was a date in which we knew the constituent or the thousand constituents, Senator Murphy, was killed in an accident, not wearing a seatbelt apparently. And it's a sad issue, but I don't know that we should be setting effective dates based upon the often bill's constituent issue. I think it makes more sense if you're going to have an effective date to have an effective on a, you know, first of the month and so forth. Apparently, as I recall, the funding matters, if we enact this by June 30th, then there is a favorable implications to the state for that. So that is what I thought originally had to affect June 30th, and we discussed it in the Judiciary Division. That is why it was changed to June 1st. But that's my recollection of this, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, we're going to move this along. I'll withdraw that motion and make the motion to adopt the committee report.
Okay, so Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say, you know, I think that this is an important public awareness issue, but it seems to me the you know, unfortunate death of your constituent can still be included in the public relations and public awareness, whether it's June 1st or June 9th.
Right. Mr. Chairman, on that motion.
Okay, so Senator Murphy, you're moving to
adopt the committee report.
Adopt. Okay. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Mr. Chairman, and then I have the A4 amendment, which takes the fiscal implication out of the bill.
Senator Murphy, on the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, the A4 amendment removes Section 6 and 7, and that's the portion where we changed the fee that the court system was worried about from $75 to $25, the surcharge. So we're removing those sections from law, so the surcharge is going to go back to $75. That makes the bill wash out to zero.
Okay. Is there further discussion on the A4 amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you know, that's probably not the most popular thing that we've done with the seatbelt bill, you know, leaving that surcharge at 75. But when you get the Supreme Court writing fiscal notes that use sketchy information at best and don't consider the whole host of cost savings that you can have in a state from primary seatbelt, well, then you have to do what you have to do to get past the fiscal note. That's just the way it is. Mr. Chairman, here's kind of what what unbelted motorists mean to the state of Minnesota. Now, in the northeastern part of the state, unbelted charges per crash, the increase in medical costs over a 10-year period went up 78%. That's, you know, over where Senator Thomasoni is from. Also, the economic impact, and these are 2005 and 2000 through 2007 seatbelt facts. There were in central Minnesota, there were 149 unbelted deaths. There were 262 unbelted injuries, for a grand total of $188 million of economic impact. And that doesn't even add in the long-term health care costs for people who have halos and things like that from not wearing seat belts. In the state of Minnesota, it was 614 unbelted deaths over that two-year period, 1,298 unbelted serious accidents for a grand total of $791 million of additional health care costs. And once again, that doesn't include those folks who spend a long time in the hospital. Members, we're looking for cheap ways to save the state money. This is the cheapest way possible. It's going to help reduce injuries, death on our highway. And, you know, if we don't want to do it to save lives, we ought to do it at least to save the state money. Senator Berglund has had an awful time trying to put together a budget that tries to hold hospitals and healthcare facilities as harmless as possible. This is one way to take a little burden off of them. Mr. Chairman, I'd move the bill as amended to the Senate floor.
Senator Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to make one comment about the statistics, and that's the area that Senator Bickerman and I represent. 96 deaths in southwestern Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And on this map, the largest city would be Marshall, which is about 13,000 people. I strongly suspect that on a per capita basis, southwestern Minnesota has the highest death rate if you look for two that are above central Minnesota, that would be St. Mm-hmm. Cloud. Mm-hmm. Maybe include Wilmer. I'm not sure where that is, but there's a population center.
Mm-hmm.
The only other place that's higher in number of deaths is the Twin City Metropolitan Area, which is about 2.5 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen some tragic deaths in southwest Minnesota where young people, 17, 18 years old, have died in crashes mm-hmm. because they weren't wearing seatbelts.
Yeah.
Senator Rickman.
You know, down where I live, they already think it's a primary. They don't have to change their ways. They automatically know they need to put it in. So I don't know what the big deal is. It makes sense.
Senator Bamasoni.
Chairman, there's an assumption that if we have a primary seatbelt on it, the seatbelts go on people automatically. You know, you just have these cars that have the seatbelts go on automatically. If they don't have them anymore, they're just going to be dangerous. But anyway, it doesn't mean that people are going to put their seatbelts on. They're not going to have unbelted accidents anymore as a result of the primary law. And in fact, in states like Maine, their primary seatbelt law only resulted in them getting about 82% compliance. Minnesota's already way above that. There's no guarantee that if you do a primary seatbelt law, that suddenly you're going to get 100% compliance. But we already have a seatbelt law. We don't need to go this next step to make sure that people put their seatbelt on. There's no guarantee that people will put their seatbelt on. There is a guarantee that people will be picked up and as a result, and that the $75 fine is going to make the seatbelt on. Probably about $150 fine instead of $100 fine. And so, once again, well, they're already paying $125 as a result of what goes on in the register. And you add another $50 to it now. And this is really, really a bad time in the economy. People can't afford to pay their clients down.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni, I appreciate your comments. You raised your hand. You mentioned earlier you had this dream about you've been stopped. I thought my dream was you would offer an amendment for slots in cars to with your other amendments.
I want to straighten out the dream, though. I wasn't stopped. I was at a stop sign stopped. I didn't have my seatbelt on, and there was a policeman behind me, so I made sure I came to a complete stop. I put my blinker on so that I didn't get picked up.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, you wouldn't have been so paranoid if you would have just had your seatbelt on.
I always wear my seatbelt, so my dream was not valid.
Just like his arguments.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, I think the one age group that would make a difference would be with young drivers, those high school drivers. I've talked mm-hmm. to the superintendents and also the public information education officers from the state patrol that go in school, see the habits of teenagers, and they know that it's not a primary defense. And I think with a primary defense, I think we will see more young people buckling up.
That's an interesting comment. That's not a decision for this committee, but that's why Senator Berglund and I favor raising cigarette taxes to about $10, I think. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Murphy, if I were to go somewhere and have Senator Tomasoni with me, and he's not buckled up, but mm-hmm. I am the driver and I am mm-hmm. buckled up, what happens when we're pulled over for something? Could mm-hmm. he get the ticket and the surcharge, or is mm-hmm. only the driver doing
no.
something?
No.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, the way that we had it under the bill before we amended it, the driver would get the surcharge and the opportunity to pay the ticket for anybody that was 15 or under in the car. But if you're an adult, you pay your own ticket, but there was only one surcharge. Under the bill now, everybody's going to get a surcharge. Senator Tomasoni would have to pay his own. He's an adult.
Some days.
Well, I wasn't going to question that, but that's basically how it goes. Everybody will get a surcharge. Everybody has to pay their own tickets unless they're underage, and then the driver has to pay it, which is that's a responsible thing to do. I mean, you're in charge of the car. And members, here's two numbers that you need to remember, 6 and 12, and it goes back to what Senator Frederickson was saying. 6% of all drivers are teenagers, but they represent 12% of all the fatal accidents on the road.
disproportionately high. The reason why in southwestern Minnesota that we have a disproportionately high crash rate and death rate, rural two-lane roads are where over 70% of all the fatal accidents happen. And, you know, in southwestern Minnesota, that's all we have are two-lane roads. And you know, we've done an excellent job building these what they call super twos, which are really nice wide highways. And they afford people bailout areas. But the problem is that, you know, some people will look at it as, you know, an extension of the Daytona 500. And unfortunately, a lot of those are, you know, are younger drivers. And I'm including everybody that's in their 20s as well. There's a reason why the insurance, you know, and the insurance agents that are around here, the folks that represent insurance, there's a reason why they pay higher insurance rates. We all know that. I mean, we were all there at one time, and I think that we all probably went out on the back road a little bit and sped. You know, that's why they have pay more insurance, and there's more fatal accidents and serious accidents. And these kids know that it's not the law, Senator Tomasoni. They know it's not the law. They can't get pulled over, so they don't care. And there's this movement now that it's not cool to wear a seatbelt if you're a kid. You know what? It's not cool to be dead either.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, those that are generally opposed is talking about the high percentage of people that are using their seatbelts right now, 85-86%, and that sounds good, and we have made a lot of progress in the last half century. But that still leaves almost 750,000 Minnesotans that are not wearing their seatbelt. And one thing that this bill will do is modify behavior on that remaining 15% or those 700,000 that are not wearing their seatbelt. It's a way to educate, change the environment in Minnesota to modify their behavior. And and the cost-benefit relationship on something like this is so strong that I think this should really be a unanimous vote. If you want to cut down on government spending and the cost of in our society to our health insurance and health care provided by government, this is a good way to do it. So let's save some lives today and vote yes on this.
Further discussion on Senator Murphy's bill. Senator Murphy moves that Senate File 42 as amended be recommended to pass. There's no further discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Murphy. Okay, then we have Senator Betzel, the last bill and potentially the last bill of the session to this committee, Senate File 191. This is the omnibus pension bill. Members, a couple things. This bill, as is always the case, has a variety of small provisions. There is a significant article in the bill that would have some discussion. There was also a request, and I forget, was it Senator Frederickson? Senator Frederickson, Senator Betzel, they might recall, requested.
I'm having trouble hearing, Mr. Chair. There's a lot of conversations going on.
Senator Betzel had requested, you have within your bill a significant provision relative to the Teachers Retirement Association,
right,
and their concerns about unfunded liabilities. And Senator Frederickson had requested not a treatise on this, but a couple of minutes from Mr. Martin on what funds we have problems with, what we should be looking at down the road. Senator Bessler, would it be okay to listen to Senator Martin?
Well, maybe Mr. Chair, I can give you, there's two articles in the bill that have fiscal impacts. I can very briefly describe, if that's the will of the committee, what the rest of the bill is, because you may have an interest in that. But as I say, there's a dealing with a minuscule thing on early retirement, and the TRA is a major issue, and that's the reason, you know, why it's here. And I do want to make sure that this committee is fully informed on that as well, too. The Pensions Commission spent a considerable amount of time dealing with that, and we're not going to gloss over it. I mean, I have to make sure people fully understand, and then we're going to have some other discussion. I do have, just to get a very technical amendment, because the Pension Commission actually finished this bill a couple of weeks ago, and so they've had an opportunity. This is a 22A amendment. I don't know if this one passed out. As I say, they've had a chance to kind of go through the full bill. it's being passed out right now. There's one provision that does deal with, I guess it could be considered substantive, but it actually is more in line with what the recommendation of the Pensions Commission. And it deals with the benefit programs for the schools. And the language that we have in the bill would probably have an unintended windfall for Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts. But this this changes it so that it actually is for the court, puts the state aid in line with the actual employer contributions. And so that's just part of this amendment. But as I say, everything else in this amendment is very technical, but that's just things that we've been able to catch in the time that we've had since the bill left the Pensions Commission. So if everybody has it, Mr. Chair, I would move the 22A amendment as a technical amendment.
We have the 22A amendment. Senator Bissell has moved the 22A amendment. Further discussion on that motion?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bissell, I was talking to Mr. Rice yesterday, and he said there was something, but I thought it was going to generate $500,000 for the St. Paul Teachers Retirement.
That's a, Mr.
That
Chair, Senator Pappas, that's a different issue. I can talk about that in just a moment,
right,
if you will. Yeah, no, that's not related to this.
All right, thank you. Should we vote against this, though?
Because no, this is a technical amendment. This has nothing to do with that particular
but
issue.
But you said it would create
a
unexpected
windfall.
We like unexpected windfalls.
Yes, you do.
Some help.
Even one.
Yeah, but I
and
don't.
And this takes that away, Mr. Chair?
Okay. Perhaps Mr. Martin can identify what it is. It's page 1, line 20 of the amendment. It refers to coordinated program. Mr. Martin, if you could describe what's happening here on this as opposed to the bill we have before us. Go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm Larry Martin, the Executive Director of the Pension Commission. The bill in article in the teacher our retirement benefit and contribution increase article increases employer contributions in a phased fashion over several years. It also provides for an increase in state aid for those same school districts. The increase in the employer contribution rates for TRA and for St. Paul teachers are only for the coordinated programs. Mm-hmm. These are the individuals who are covered by Social Security. The aid provision, however, is increasing the aid based on the salaries of all members, including the basic program members. TRA has a small number of Minneapolis teacher basic members, former Minneapolis teacher plan members who are basic, and St. Paul teachers has a small remnant group from before 1977 hires who are basic members. So all we're bringing into play is that the aid matches the employer contribution and does not include the salaries of a couple of hundred school employees in primarily Minneapolis and St. Paul.
So Mr. Chairman? So Mr. Martin, is this windfall like $10,000?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we're talking about ultimately 2% of pay of probably the higher or highest paid 150 or 200 teachers in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I can't put a dollar figure to it at this moment.
We have Senator Bissell's 22A amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just respond to Senator Pappas's question before I get into the bill itself. Just in the last week or so, Mr. Rice brought to my attention an issue, and I would have liked to have convened a meeting of the Pensions Commission to discuss it. There wasn't time, given all there wasn't even a room, there wasn't a quorum, I couldn't do it. Apparently the House has adopted the language, so you know this may have to be an issue for conference committee. Senator Pappas, you're on the Pensions Commission, so if you go to conference committee, you will be on the conference committee there too. There's something called amortization aid, which was part of the tax bill, and I suspect it's going to happen regardless of whether the tax bill passes or not. Does the amortization aid go for? Anyway, amortization aid is something that goes out to the cities, and it goes out to the funds here. In the early 90s, there was a, and I guess Senator Waldorf had was responsible for what happened here. The decision was made, the Pensions Commission, that if a pension fund got to 100% funding, then they would lose. Then there was no reason to keep paying amortization aid to them, so it would stop. And so that's what it said. And so, in fact, some of these funds have reached 100%, and the amortization aid stopped. The trouble is, some of them have then fallen back under 100% funding, and so they would like to recapture the aid that was coming to them. Just last year, we had that issue happen with the Duluth teachers, where they had reached 100%, the amortization aid stopped, they fell below it, so they wanted to get it back coming to them. Apparently, it's just recently discovered that some funds that have had 100% funding and have now fallen back are due to lose their amortization aid. And if it's lost, it doesn't go back to the general fund. There's a formula where it's going to go. Part of it's going to go to TRA. Part of it's going to go to PERA, I believe. I mean, it's designed where it's going to go. So the decision has to be made whether we want to steer the amortization aid back to those funds that have been getting it and lost it only because they hit the 100% and are now falling back. Obviously, if they're 100%, you know, we're not going to keep giving the aid to them. But if they fell below the 100% threshold, I guess the decision has to be made: should we should we go back and steer it back to them instead of sending it to the places that have it designed to?
Well, Mr. Chairman, yeah. And Senator Bessel, I mean, aren't there a number of the funds that have fallen below 100%, like just have the TRA, weren't they at 100% and they've fallen behind?
Well, that's Mr. Chair. Yeah, but they're not part of this amortization aid.
They're not.
We're talking the Minneapolis Police and Fire, that they're affected by it. I don't actually have my list of who's affected. But as I say, this is going to be, the bill is probably going to go to conference committee. I'm certainly going to go to conference committee. And what I intend, what I would believe would be that the members of the Pensions Commission are probably going to be in the conference committee. So we will have an opportunity to discuss that. It apparently has been adopted in the House bill. It's not part of the Senate bill right now. So the issue will have to be discussed. But that's the answer to that question. Senator Pappas. Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to briefly describe the other things that are in the pension bill.
Senator Bessel, before that, Senator Frederickson.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bessel, yeah. It would seem to me one question we should ask if they've fallen back from 100% is why that happened. Is it something beyond the pension plan control, like the market has, as we all know, substantially fallen, and it's really because of no management issue on their part,
right?
Or have they pursued perhaps benefit increases that could not be expected to be reasonably sustained?
Mr. Chair, and this is also something that you should keep in mind when we talk about the TRA issue later on. When we're talking about pensions, there's a couple of sources of funding for the pensions. The primary, you know, there's, unlike private companies, employers and employees contribute to pensions, public pensions, state pensions. So each of us contributes to our own, or we contribute to our own pensions, and the employers have to pay their share. Now, the employers being government entities, those are tax dollars that go into them, but they are employer-employee contributions. For the major pension funds, and sort of from some minor areas in here too, we have a standing state appropriation. The state government budget bill that I carried and passed the Senate conference committee report yesterday had the standing appropriation for the major pension funds, and this has been going on for years. Then the money gets invested, and that's where, among other things, the stock market can affect where the funds are. We try to put them on an amortization schedule so that we know where they're going to be like in 20 or 30 years. It's like your home mortgage. The money isn't due today, but it's going to become due. And as the funds start falling below 100%, in the short run, it may not be a problem, but when they start falling below 100% significantly, then it is a concern. And the stock market obviously has affected the performance of some of the pension funds. But there could be some other areas too, as you indicated, Mr. Chair and Senator Ferguson. Some of the funds probably gave too generous of benefits. In the 90s, when the stock markets were doing extremely well, many of the funds gave out better benefits with legislative approval under the theory that, well, they hadn't been keeping up with inflation, so now it was time to catch up. But when you gave out those benefit improvements, some of them were probably more that could be sustained in the long run. We actually corrected that a few years ago in the pension bill, one that I had carried, that said that we're going to cap off future benefit increases. It's not right to give out overly generous benefit increases when the economy is good, just as we should not be not giving out benefit increases when the economy is bad. I mean, you should even it out. So, but we have that in place right now, but if obviously it takes a few years for all this to take place.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Senator
Betzel, I think I just want to clarify for the committee that you're really talking about cost of living adjustment so that you maintain the integrity of the pension funds, so the buying power, really, for the pension year. So that should be even in good times and bad times. And that cost of living adjustment should be pretty close to inflation.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, again, that was the point that we weren't keeping up with inflation. And so when the so in the 90s, when the performances were very, very good, then we tried to catch up. And actually, we probably went a bit too far. But yeah, we should try to even it out. And I think we've taken significant steps in recent years to do exactly that. But those are the problems. There's numerous problems. Actuarial assumptions can change, too. I mean, we base a lot of the pension performances on what we believe is going to be the case many decades from now. And unfortunately, what we've seen is that, first of all, people are working longer and living longer. When all these people live longer, doggone it, it costs the pension funds money.
What do you think?
There's a term that I like to refer back to that the actuaries like. It's called a positive mortality rate. Actuaries like that term. It means a lot of people die. Okay, but in pension speak, that's a very good thing to happen. It's bad as it affects you. And in pensions, you know, there's nothing fair. I mean, you can pay a lot of money into your pension plan and then die and then not get the benefits of it. Or, you know, you could live a long time and get more than you put into it. I mean, that's just how the system seems to work.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, it's also a positive thing, correct, to have people working longer, paying into their pension fund. And so, but, you know, we also have in this bill some early retirement incentives.
Well,
so, because we want to let young people into the workforce. So there's a lot of conflicting needs that we have.
Senator Tomasoni.
I'm not sure this fits into the discussion. There was a survey in Denmark, and they came up with a conclusion that obesity and smoking are actually good for society. If people died sooner, it didn't cost them so much money.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've got an uncle who's trying to quit smoking. I'm saying, please don't. We need the money. But that's another issue. So anyway, back to the bill, Mr. Chair. As I said, we're going to spend a little bit more time, but particularly talking about a lot of these issues with the TRA thing. But if the members wish to have it, I could make a very quick overview of the other things that are in this bill, just in case it raises any flags. Article 1 deals with an issue that actually gets to what we're talking about here, where we used to have the active fund where the current employees were paying in the employer-employer share plus the contributions plus the stock market. Those were the current employees. Once they retired, they had moved into what's called a post fund, where there was no more contributions from the employer-employee, and it was only the stock market, basically, that was going to decide that. But we put a triggering mechanism in last year's pension bill that said that if they fell below a certain threshold, which was below 85% in 2 years or below 80% in 1 year, then we would merge the active and the post funds. When we were talking about this a year ago, we were assuming it may happen, it may never happen. Well, of course, it has happened because of the stock market. And so as a result, there has been the merger between the active and the post funds. Article 1 just kind of cleans up some of the statutory language we need in order to continue making that happen. This actually makes it more stable. Now, we talked about this last year. Obviously, there was some concern about, at the time, from the current employees saying, wait a minute, why should we have an underfunded post fund merged with the active fund? Because then I, as an active employee, are going to be assuming the liabilities of the post fund.
which may be true, but on the other hand, no current employee wants to retire and go into an underfunded post fund. But as I say, that's already passed, it's in the law, and that's been taken care of. So Article 1 simply completes the transition as we needed to do it. Article 2 deals with some disability provisions. We had some major changes in recent years. We had too many people retiring with disability pensions, and it was costing a lot of money. We made significant changes in doing that. This kind of revisits some of those issues and cleans it on up. Basically, some of these people are going to retire anyway, but they were receiving overly generous pensions because they retired under a disability. So we allowed the disability provisions for a while, and then this makes some changes that they can transfer to disability status, for instance, to normal retirement at age 55 instead of making them wait until age 65. Some of this is because of health care issues. We give a longer period of time for them to file for disability. Instead of 180 days, they've got 18 months. So this kind of, as I say, revisits some of those issues and kind of cleans them up. Again, everything we're describing here is what the Pension Commission heard and has recommended. Article 3 is just applying to one person in the correction system to put them in, which is, gets into the issue you may have heard about earlier in the session, where the governor was proposing to move some people out of the corrections plan and moving them into the general plan. This bill doesn't do that, but that wasn't a significant issue. And it had nothing to do with pension issues and more health care benefits, because some people were working too short of a time and were getting... They could work 3 years, say, for the Department of Corrections and get 10 years worth of health care benefits. And so this kind of delves a little bit into that area, although this bill does not go to that particular issue that the governor proposed. Article 4 has a number of administrative provisions. One in particular you should be aware about, because it's an issue out of Duluth, where for a number of years they had erroneous payments that were being made, and because they were thought they were paying into getting various benefits, and they've got to go back in time to try to correct those and, in fact, recover some of the money. It's easier to do it when you've got current employees that were underpaying or overpaying or whatever. Much more difficult for people who are already retired to do that. But this actually goes back and does allow PERA to collect some of the money, even from the retirees. They're not happy with it, but frankly, it's a series of errors that were made over a long period of time. And this affects mainly the city of Duluth and Duluth Airport Authority. That's Article 5. Article 6 and 7, let me just skip over that for a minute, because those are the heart of the fiscal issues that we have before us. Article 8 deals with the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund. Senator Pappas has been working on this and is quite aware of it. They've also had some problems where they had limited the amount that they were going to be paying in, but they had some very generous post-retirement cost of living increases, which have been too costly to the funds. And we've had a pilot program going the last 2 years. This kind of revisits the pilot program and caps their annual adjustment mechanism at 5%. But this is going to expire on June 30th of 2011, so we're going to be continuing working on this. Article 9 deals with the Fairmont Police Association. Senator Rosen had an issue and changed the board where they extend out their amortization target because it was due to expire in 2010. And they're not funded to do that, so this just gives them an extra 10 years to reach their targets. Article 11 deals with what we've been working on for a number of years to local firefighters association. There's about 800 firefighters association. They're all managing their own retirement funds and so forth. Some do a very good job. Many do a very bad job at it. And frankly, this is not in the public's interest to allow that. So we're starting a volunteer effort to have them migrate their retirement fund to the State Board of Investments so that they don't have to handle the paperwork, they don't have to make the decisions. Obviously, it was an issue with a lot of these local funds due to have local control, but some of them screwed it up and screwed it up badly. And we haven't forced anybody to move into this plan, but at some point we're going to have to, because some of them it's costing the taxpayers and costing, frankly, these pensions a lot of money when the local relief associations get it wrong. Article 11 deals with a number of provisions that the state auditor has worked on with the voluntary release associations, some changes and reforms, you know, just to make sure that they're properly funded. Article 12, simply some drafting errors that we happen to catch. And Article 13 are some just a one-person provisions. Sarah Skolgan, Wieger, Bach, and Han had constituent issues that were incorporated here. So, Mr. Chair, members, those are the areas that really don't have any fiscal impacts. But there are two articles that have fiscal impacts. If you don't mind, I'll deal with the easier one first. That's Article 7, the Minsku retirement provisions. You might recall we had in this committee this past week, Senator Bach had a provision on early retirement incentives, and this also passed off the Senate floor. This provides some early retirement incentives for Minsku. Now, that's the fiscal note for the current biennium reflects that. And in fact, this fiscal note was just revised yesterday. And Mr. Stanton, if you're here, you may want to come on up forward now to talk about this. Trying to make sense of the fiscal note does raise an issue or two because it's not entirely sure whether there is any cost, because we're talking, again, about people that can leave who are being paid a lot of money right now, and they can take early retirement. It's my understanding Minsku is not thrilled with this, but they can live with it.
So, like it.
Mr. Stanton, if you would come on forward, and you may want to address Article 7 on the early retirement incentives.
Mr. Stanton.
Mr. Chair, members, actually Minsku is supportive of the legislation, and I believe they have a representative here if you wanted to hear directly from them. Actually, if you read the legislation, it doesn't appropriate any money for any early separation incentive. It's simply a authorizing legislation that allows Minsku, the Minsku Board of Trustees, to design and offer retirement benefits to its employees. They can unilaterally offer those benefits. In other words, it isn't a matter of collective bargaining, and they can target them to specific positions. Right now, any estimate is a pretty wild guess because the Minsku board hasn't designed any program yet, and it's up to the college presidents to offer the incentive. And if they offer an incentive, they have to pay for it out of their own money, their own budgets. And that the reason that was put in there is so that there would be some savings connected to it. Obviously, there would have to be a good policy reason or some savings reasons why you would offer an incentive, otherwise you wouldn't offer it. And it's not grievable at all if they don't offer the incentive. When they put together the fiscal note, they originally had assumed that it would be offered, the person over at Minsku had assumed that it would be offered to everyone. I pointed out that that isn't the way the legislation is drafted. So then they said, well, they estimated that five people at each campus might take it. That's just, right now there is no incentive designed. That's just an estimate. The higher education bill that passed does have authorization that they could use stimulus money to some of their stimulus money for the separation incentive. Actually, that's a good use of one-time money because the cost of early retirement is up front and the savings is realized down the road from it. So Minsku is supportive of it. All of the faculty unions work with Minsku on this. And I've been told through Minsku, a person at Minsku, that they checked with finance and finance did not oppose it. So. That's the information I'm operating on.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, this is my provision, and Mr. Stanton is correct that in the higher ed bill, in the federal stimulus article or section, we do authorize the use of federal stimulus money for early retirement incentives. As all of our colleges are having to downsize, it's a bridge to the next biennium where there's going to be significantly less higher ed money. I mean, there's only 2% cut this year. But in the out years, it will be significantly more. And, you know, I think we'll start seeing notices going out about programs closing at different Minsku campuses. And I think that even right now at MCTC, they're talking about closing the carpentry program. And I hope that's done in collaboration with the unions and also with the other college presidents so that, I assume it's going to be done, so that you can still get those programs, but they just won't be you know, duplicated if they're in, you know, geographic, reasonable geographic distance from each other.
Okay. So Senator Pappas, in the context of your bill, and as Mr. Stanton has discussed, this is permissive language.
Yes.
And if the campuses, and again, can this be done campus by campus, or would this
yes.
be a...
Correct. Mr. Chair, yes. In fact, that was the, if you read the legislation, it can be targeted right down to positions, which is very unusual. In past, the early retirement incentives were given to, offered to just about everyone, and some of the people that plan to retire anyhow got them. What the design of this is to let the administration pick the exact positions they want to either downsize, or maybe they want to save a young faculty's position by retiring off an older faculty position. It's specific to positions. And the other thing is whoever designate, whatever campus designates it, they have to pay for it out of their own budgets. And that, so they're not going to be willy-nilly. In terms of, in past, one of the criticisms of the state auditor and or the legislative auditor in the past is that the people granting the early retirement incentives weren't the people paying for it. Well, in this case, they would have to be.
Okay, Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Senator Pappas knows this. Is this the same bill that we passed separately? Because I thought it only had 3 years of health insurance coverage.
Different.
But this one says it has cash incentives not to exceed 1 year of base salary.
Yeah. So this doesn't amplify. You're going to speak up. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, you're referring to Senator Bach's bill, which is a different bill. That this is the bill that passed, or that was before Higher Education Committee and passed out of the Pension Commission. Thanks.
Okay. Sir Betzel? I'm sorry, Sarah Olson, I'm sorry.
I'm trying to wrap my mind around this. What would an incentive look like if you were, you know, if you were trying to essentially incent a, because of reduction in force, to leave, and they're, before they're eligible for whatever retirement system they're in, it might take a lot. I mean, paying, you know, health
yes.
benefits we've been dealing with. How much savings can accrue, or do you end up having a pretty large commitment when you're not having the revenue coming in because you don't need people? So I can see why hiring could have a difficulty, but how, what would a typical, or if there is
sure.
such a thing, incentive package look like?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, let me just give you a quick example. I deal with retirees all the time as they're retiring out. The typical retiree at a state university would be at the top of the pay scale or near there. They'd be making about $95,000. The average incoming...
Benefits or without?
Without. And the average incoming faculty member would be about $55,000 under our contract, actually a little bit less than $55,000, again, without benefits. So, you know, if you're going to layoffs are usually done by seniority. Also, because of tenure, there's usually a two-year process. If you can give the senior faculty member an incentive, and it would have to be a decent-sized incentive in order to make them move, and get them to retire early, you're obviously, and keep the young faculty member that's making just about half as much, you're obviously going to realize some savings for several years. The problem with the early retirement incentive is it requires upfront money, and that's why they had the authorization of the stimulus money, and then you'd realize the savings in the years following. By
Mr. Chair, I understand that aspect, but I was wondering what an incentive might
Mr. Chair, the Minskew, just the preliminary talks I've had with staff members, and again, this hasn't been approved by the Minskew board and so forth, they were looking at an incentive of perhaps $50,000, in order to,
one time,
in order to,
and going
Well, what it could be used for is either cash or placed in the post-retirement health care savings plan. The post-retirement health care savings plan is a tax-free health care savings account that we have in Minnesota for all public employees in Minnesota. And it could be a contribution into that. And then those who want to use it to buy health insurance, continue their health insurance, could use it for health insurance. And others that didn't want to use it for health insurance, maybe they have a coverage by a spouse or whatever, they could save it for in retirement to pay their Medicare Part B or a Medicare supplement policy or whatever. I think, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I think it would vary greatly. I can tell you that right now the average age of retirees of state university faculty has been creeping up. I think we're up to almost 64 now, the average age. But there may be some people, if their department is being downsized, I mean, we're going to be looking at some pretty severe cutbacks. If they're going to close down a program, it may be that the incentive would be offered to somebody 60 years old. So it will vary.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we did put a 3-year cap on post-retirement health care benefits in the other bill, but this one doesn't seem to have any cap. It just says employer contributions for the post-retirement health care plan. And I'm wondering if, you know, if somebody retired at age 55 and they can't get Medicare till they're 65, that's 10 years of health care benefits that I suppose it could negotiate for.
Sure.
That's a pretty significant benefit and could probably exceed the 1-year base salary. I'm just thinking that, I don't know, maybe the campuses won't do it because it's coming out of their budget. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I mean, if that's a good enough control because they're going to pay for it, but I do have some concerns knowing how expensive health care benefits are.
Sure. It may cost a significant amount of money. I mean, they will have to, Minsky would have to put its own cap on the benefits. You know, it takes money to move people. And one of the reasons why we put great flexibility into letting Minsky design its own program is Minsky, a lot of people don't realize how big and complex the workforce of Minsky is. A third of all state employees work for Minsky. And they have, I think, 17 different unions and personnel plans. And what might work for one might not work for another. How much it takes to get a full professor to retire might be quite different than how much it takes to get an AFSCME employee to retire and so forth. So that what the bill does is give Minsky flexibility to design different types of programs for different categories of employees, and it would be voluntary. Also, it's voluntary on the part of the employee to take it. I should point out that it does take money to get people to retire. I'll give you an example. At Moorhead, right now, under our contract, if there's downsizing required, they can designate whole departments for early retirement incentives. And at Moorhead, they have some pretty serious financial problems. They designated a bunch of departments this spring, and they were offered a full year of salary. And out of 81 eligible people, only one person took it. And the reason is a lot of people right now in this economy think their job is their best security.
So,
Mr. Chairman, if they're required to downsize, you're saying the only way that you can move an employee out is to, I mean, they can't just reduce the force? They have to give an incentive? If you cut out a department, for example, What you have to pay with, because you don't have the income, there's an assumption that those students are somehow going to be there, but they may not.
Mr. Chairman, it gets complicated. These faculty have contracts. They have to be given notice. Often it's the younger faculty that don't have as much seniority that are the ones that are getting laid off. They may have to be offered a position at another campus. You know, it's extremely complex.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzel, are the figures on the fiscal note something that Senator Pappas has already paid for in the omnibus bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, first of all, the fiscal note that you see, I guess, was just revised yesterday, but Senator Pappas and I reviewed an earlier version of this, and to be honest with you, I don't recall. I think Minsky was absorbing this cost.
It was much higher, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bethel. It's $4 million, but remember, the campuses have to pay for it. It's voluntary, and they can use federal stimulus money that will be allocated to the campuses to pay for the transition. And we're downsizing the whole system, and we're going to have some transitional costs in the process.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzel, would that be true also for the costs that would be in the education department? Did Senator Stump pay for that in his bill?
That's always
the TRA cost.
There's a fiscal note from the Department of Education.
That, Mr. Chair, that would deal with the TRA issue, which is the next issue I'm going to be talking about. That's the major issue. I want to get the minuscule issue out of the way first, but the TRA one is the huge one we need to discuss. So
I'm happy to hear the discussion, but I want to know if we have the money to pay for it in these bills or if we're trying to spend money we don't have.
Mr. Chair, that's the next issue we're going to be discussing as soon as we can get this Minsky thing discussion done, because here that's a major issue. Yes, you're correct. But I'm prepared to talk.
I'm correct that
we are
trying to spend money we don't have.
Mr. Chairman, can I talk about the TRA thing now? Senator Berglund, not with the Minsky issue. The Minsky issue, there's federal stimulus money available for that.
So let's finish the discussion on the Minsky issue before we go on to TRA. Senator Roebling?
Well, Mr. Chair, one of the things that concerns me, I see this does have a sunset in 2014, this early retirement incentive. But the next issue we're going to deal with as we move into that is one of the things that they're bringing it to us for the teachers is that it addresses the pension inequity for post-1989 teachers who have an age 66 retirement age. And I'm thinking, they offered this now for 4 years, and pretty soon the other staff who haven't gotten this benefit during this 4-year window are back here saying, well, that's not fair. It's not fair that those professors or that staff got this benefit, and now we're not going to be able to get it. You have to give it to all of us, because that's exactly what we're hearing from TRA right now. And so we have to think about this. This is a setting of precedent, and it might be one that this state cannot afford to do forever, but that will be the push once it's started.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, I would assume that you'd been on the Pension Commission for quite a while, because that's exactly what happens on the Pension Commission. We try to do the best we can and set policy, and you know, sometimes you do something right here, it may seem a small cost, and all of a sudden you realize there's a huge cost down the road, so you make adjustments. But we're constantly getting people coming to us and said, well, since you did this thing, even if it was only involving one person a couple of years ago, now that's the precedent, so you have to do it. So we do have that thrown at us, you know, many times. And you may be absolutely right on this.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the bill in front of me, but if you do read the bill, it can be unilaterally offered by the employer, and it cannot be grieved. If a person does not get it, it cannot be grieved. There's an exception to PELRA along those lines.
She's just saying that the sunset's not going to matter.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Further discussion on the Minsky provision of this bill. Okay, thank you, Mr. Stanton.
Okay, Mr. Chair, then let's, if I'd like to spend some time discussing the TRA article, which I believe is Article 6 of the bill. And just to put it into context, first of all, there's TRA is the primary teacher's retirement fund for most teachers in the state. There are two other teacher groups, by the way. The Duluth teachers and the St. Paul teachers have their own fund. A few years ago, Minneapolis had its own fund, but they were so far down in the sufficiency, I think they were at 59% or whatever, that we closed them out and moved them over to TRA. So what I'm talking about is mainly TRA, but this does also affect Duluth and St. Paul teachers. As I discussed earlier, we do have a goal to try to have long-term sufficiency for these funds. And as of 2002, TRA was 100% funded. But over the past couple of years, they've gone downhill. It's not a lot of it's in due to the stock market, but there have been other factors, too. I talked about people living too long. As of last December, they're down to 80%. I don't know if there's any revised numbers since then, but the trend is troubling because every year they keep going down further and further. And you get to a point, and this is a major fund with billions of dollars, at some point, if you don't start taking corrective action, then it can spiral out of control. And it hasn't been since the 1930s that a pension fund has actually failed in Minnesota. But you simply cannot have that happen. So we are trying to take corrective action in this bill to put them on the correct footing. Now, there's a number of factors why it's gone below, and I talked about the stock market. I talked about people living longer, changes in actuarial assumptions. Perhaps, and this is my view more than anything, I guess, is I think the rule of 90 has contributed to some of the problems there, too. And I think we've all had teachers saying that it was unfair because in 1989, the legislature gave the rule of 90 to current employees. No teacher has ever gone into teaching in Minnesota expecting the rule of 90. What happened was in 1989, there was a floor amendment, and as I understand it, because I wasn't here at the time, the Duluth teachers' bill was on the floor. And the rule of 90 was put on. It was one of those late-night things. The Pension Commission was not involved in this process at all. And in fact, I think the members of the Pension Commission objected to this. But the rule of 90 was given. And for those who don't understand it, it means you add your age plus years of service. If that equals 90, you get to retire. I'll use myself an example. If I had gone into teaching instead of gone in the Army and gone and being a lawyer and so forth, I'm 58 years old. I could be retired today under the rule of 90. And like many people who have the rule of 90, they retire, they get their pension checks, and they go on off and start working another job, which is not what pensions were ever intended for. Now, is there an inequity because some people got the rule of 90 and some did not? Absolutely. Does that mean you got to extend the rule of 90 to everybody who doesn't have it? You can't afford it. We simply cannot afford it. It's not going to happen. It would be billions of dollars to pay for that, and we don't have billions of dollars. And again, where's the billions of dollars going to come from? The employers and the employees, well, the employers are the school districts, and they're going to say, fine, state, send us the money, and we'll have rule of 90. I think if we shaved off the K-12 formula about 2 to 3%, we could pay for rule of 90. I don't think that's going to happen. It's not going to happen. So we've had to find some other ways. Now, we've got a couple of dilemmas in here. TRA is heading in a downward trend, again, because there's too many costs to the fund, because people are living longer, because of the stock market and other things. We got to find a solution to right the ship. We've got to find a way to make the fund so it is not going to be going into the really dangerous zone in which it is headed.
Sarah Wilson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bissell, when did the rule of 90 end?
No, the rule of 90 was applicable for employees hired through, I think it was July 1st of 1989. Anybody hired after that date does not get rule of 90. Anybody who was employed before that date gets it. So, and as I say, it was never anything that anybody expected. It was just something the legislature did and handed it over to existing employees at the time. And I think
cynically, I can say what the idea was, okay, future employees, you're going to have to figure out your own pension benefits. But those who were in the pipeline at that time got the rule of 90 because that's what the legislature passed in 1989.
So, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, somewhere, now I don't know if I'm imagining this, but there was a rule of 85 for a while. And what period of time was that? Anybody know?
1982 to 1986. And I think even in 1989, people realized for the long term we couldn't afford the rule of 85. And they realized in that time period we couldn't afford it. And so I think there was a desire for some people to hurry up and, you know, get it locked down because it was going to go away fast. And so some people locked it into the rule of 90, and that's what happened. And it was the pact was made with the devil at the time, and that's what happened. Well, we'll talk. I think we may be talking about legislative pensions in a few minutes when Senator Tomasoni has an amendment, but we'll get around to that a little later. But anyway, we've got to do something to correct it. Now, how are you going to correct it? Well, again, we have a standing state appropriation that goes to TRA. Obviously, in this time and climate, increasing that appropriation is not possible. That was part of the bill that has passed yesterday in the state government budget bill. We can hope the stock market turns around fast and has dramatically better results. I think it's going to turn around, but I don't think we're going to get the results in the near future that we would hope to have. A nice plague would help, you know, but that's not going to, you know, you can't, that wouldn't, I don't think that's going to change things. So now you're down to basically about the only thing that are left, and that's, and we've got employer and employee contributions. Now we can tell the school districts, okay, we want you to increase the employer contributions, and that's what this bill does. Over a four-year period, it gradually ramps it up so the employers, the school districts, are paying more for every year over a four-year period in order to pay for the employer contributions. Now, the school districts are going to come to us and say, okay, you want us to pay employer contributions. How do you want us to do that? And the options are limited. We can tell the school districts, pay for it out of your own hide. They're not going to be happy with that. I can't think of a school district in the state that's going to say, we've got the money to pay for the increased employer contributions, but that is certainly one option. We can put language that is not in this bill, if that's the will of this committee, and you can send me off to the tax committee and say, go seek levy authority so that the school districts can levy for the increased employer contributions. Higher property taxes to do that. That's an option, as I say, not in this bill, but it's certainly an option. We can, in the future, increase state funding to the school districts. That is what this bill does. And you can see this over a four-year period, and that is what the fiscal note reflects. Starting in 2012, we would be paying $20 million, and then for fiscal year 13, it ramps up each year because, again, the employer contributions are increasing each year. So in 2013, it's 41. I don't have the exact numbers, but in year three, it could be up to about $70 million. Again, the state payments. And in year four, around $94 million. So over a four-year period, this could come up to over $200 million of increased contributions to the school districts. Now, I say that keeping in mind, if we do this, we're making a commitment in the future to doing this before we've steered $1 back into the classrooms. So this is a quite serious thing. Let me now, there's another side to this, and it is kind of complicated, but you got to have all the pieces of the puzzle before you. The other side is that, as I said, the employees, the teachers, also pay for their own pensions. The teachers for many years have been raising issues, and rightly so, that they feel that they pay quite a bit, but what they get out of their pensions are not very good. Now, those who have been hired after July 1st of 89 who don't have the rule of 90 under current law would have to work until age 66 until they retire. You've got some kindergarten teachers, you know, said, I can't get down to the classroom floor and do all the kinds of things at that age. Now, you know, Now, we could simply tell them, okay, you're going to pay more because we're going to have increased employer and employee contributions to pay for this proposal that we have. The teachers are rightly saying that if we're paying more for our pension, we'd like to get something out of it. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to have 2%, have our pensions increased by 2% and get the very same plan that we've got right now. And I think they're making a fairly good point. So what this bill would do would be increasing some of their benefits that they get so that if they've worked for 30 years, they can retire at age 62, as an example. So there are some things that they would pay more. Now, that's the way the bill is structured right now. Now, we have a proposal to deal with the fiscal note, but I want to make sure you understand the issues as we have before us, the way the bill is structured. Mr. Chair.
Sir,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bitzel, I don't know how the investment practices work with this, but so we increase the amount that the employer and the employee is paying, and we've got a volatile stock market so that we invest it and we immediately start losing the base. Do they end up, do they have any fixed investments, you know, even though they probably don't have any, virtually no interest rate at times like this, they wouldn't be losing it. I don't know how that investment practices, but just because we're pouring more in, if we've got a volatile or losing proposition here, we're not really gaining. And that makes me very nervous about, you can say we're paying him more, and assuming some things that have been going on in the past, how can we afford increased benefits into a future when we don't know what the future of our investment and return on investment is capable of producing to keep these people?
Well, and Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, that's an excellent question. The money through the TRA funds are invested through the State Board of Investments. There are people who are here that can actually talk about the investment practices far better than I can, and Mr. Bergstrom is hacking or whatever. If you want to, are able to come forward and talk about to respond to the long range investment strategies, that would be helpful because it does tie into this very issue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Renzel, I think that's extremely important to know what those assumptions are, yep, before you start immediately throwing in benefit increases. I mean, it's one thing to we may be needing more just to try to keep at an even keel. If we've been slipping back, this, yep, isn't going to fill the hole. That's what makes me very uncomfortable.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, let me just also add one other. Again, it's a complex issue here. We can go ahead with the proposal that we have in this bill without the teacher contribution and the benefit increase. Those two go hand in hand. If it were our desire to not have a benefit increase, we can tell the teachers, fine, you're not going to get a benefit increase. You got the very same program you're going to have. You're going to pay the very same contribution you're making. And we can do that within the parameters of this bill. But in order to take care of TRA, we've got to have the increased employer contributions. So, you know, I can segregate those out if that were the will to do that. But I can't make the employer contributions disappear without having something to take care of. But in talking about the long-range investments, I think Ms. Hacking is in a better position to talk about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bitzel, what that benefit was to being able to retire at 62. Mm-hmm. But then we have our school districts that are committing through agreement to post-retirement benefits, that they're putting out bonds or will be going to property tax. That is a growing obligation, because if they're at 62, they've got that window of time before. It's not 65. I think for those of us that are closing in on that time, the Social Security rate, age is going up.
Yes.
And you aren't eligible for Medicare until you're eligible for the retirement, I don't believe. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can get Medicare at 62. You're shaking your head one way or another. Yeah. You're blurring me up if I'm wrong.
Right.
You're correct.
Okay. And by the way, the State Board of Investments through March of 2009, from 1980 through March of 2009, has had about an average rate of annual return of about 9.5%. They do very good. So, But Ms. Hacking can talk about the investment strategies if that's desired, because it does affect what is we're talking about here.
Ms. Hacking?
Mr. Chair, Laurie Hacking, Teachers Retirement Association. To your question, the State Board of Investment has a diversified portfolio. It is not totally invested in the stock market. It has a very sizable portion invested in bonds, and also a sizable portion invested in alternative assets, which are also not stock market related. So it does have a diversified portfolio. And in most years, that diversification has helped cushion when stock markets have gone down. Unfortunately, this most recent period, nothing helped. Most of the investment asset classes suffered. But in other declines, the diversification has provided a very good cushion. And as Senator Betzolt said, over long periods of time, the rate of return that SBI has generated has been excellent.
Mr. Chair, could you, I don't know what your prognosis is, given the volatility and all of the efforts to do one thing or another in managing our money supply and all of these things, what kind of, at what level of optimism do you have for this being just a cyclical thing, or are we into something deeper that is going to be more challenging as in these next years?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that's a very difficult thing to predict. We just had a meeting a few days ago where Mr. Bicker, who is the director of the State Board of Investment, collected all the sort of forecasts of the major banking and investment institutions, and they are still, you know, predicting a rate of return given our asset allocation of 9% that's not to say we're going to get that next year, but again, those are long-term projections. So I think there is reasonable optimism that we will come out of this downturn. When it will happen and how quickly we will rebound is really anyone's guess.
Cyrils.
And so, Mr. Chair, part of what we're doing is reacting to what the immediate effect of the downturn. Could it come back? Are you optimistic enough that it could come back without doing anything, or is something required, and that can in fact be managed rather than putting it in the losing that investment as well?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, it's a very good question. We believe that the deficiency that we're carrying right now is so large that it's unreasonable to expect a market rebound to take care of that. However, if we are lucky enough to get a very good rebound, there is a provision in the bill that says that those increases that are in the bill would expire or would be reduced if in fact we take care of our deficiency and get back on our solid footing again, then the contribution rate increases that are in the bill would be rolled back. So we've tried to provide for that rosier scenario if that unfolds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I think I heard Senator Betzold say is that they need the employer contribution to make the fund solvent. So basically, that's what the employer contribution of up to 2% over those couple years will go toward. And the 2% that the teachers are going to put in, the active employees, will go to their early retirement fund. So they're not contributing to making the fund solvent. They're contributing to their additional benefit. Is that right, Senator
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, the cost of the earlier retirement provisions is approximately 1.9% of payroll, and the teacher contributions will go up by 2% of payroll, so slightly more than the cost of the benefit improvement. However, if after that phase-in period there remains a deficiency in the fund, which is possible you know, because we can't predict the markets, then employee contributions would go up in tandem with employer contributions. So if the fund does not regain its footing, then, in fact, teachers would be contributing to helping to address any remaining deficiency.
Was it considered, and I know that the teachers union probably would consider it, but having the pension increase only go up 0.25% a year, and then so in the 4 years it would be only 1% for the employer, 1% for the teachers. And it would cover the deficiency, or very nearly cover the projected deficiency. And, you know, there wouldn't be a big new early retirement benefit, but the benefit to the employees is a solvent defined pension, which most people in this world do not have anymore. I mean, that's worth a lot, a pension fund that is stable and that you know you're going to be able to draw on is a huge benefit. And, you know, this whole thing is really troubling me, Mr. Chin and members, because yesterday we passed that E-12 bill, and it had a complete freeze on it for our school districts. And, you know, that's not what any one of us wanted to do. But the first dollar that we give them, basically, in the next biennium is going to help cover their payment toward these pension increases. And Senator Betzel alluded to it. It won't go into the classroom. It isn't going to do anything for students. It's just, it'll be the first dollar in because this is where we're committing it right now. And I really struggle with that. You know, and the teachers will be putting in more money, certainly. And I have brothers and sisters that are teachers. But they're going to get a significant benefit out of it. But for $200 million, what are the kids going to get? I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, what are the kids going to get? And so, Mr. Chair, I'd like to strike Article 2, or Article 6. I need to strike Article 6. But I may come back with a proposal with a 0.25% increase, but I don't have it with me today. But I didn't realize that it could be, the fund could be made solvent with a 1.1%. And I'm sitting here thinking the first priority we as a legislature should have is to make the fund solvent. I agree with that. And then once the fund is solvent and our school districts are in more stable footing, then we can talk about benefits. But we should not be talking about increased benefits when we can't do that under the current circumstances.
Sarah Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, unless I'm wrong, I thought the increased benefit was retiring at 62 instead of 65. I'm not sure how you cut that in a quarter unless you would have it ramped down just a few months ahead of 65 or 66.
66.
If that's what you're paying for, that's kind of hard to do. I do feel that it's very hard to defend changing that kind of a benefit at the time when technically even we're having challenges in replacing teachers at the K-12 level, having to attract people in. I don't think we should be incenting early retirement there. And by the same token, that retirement is not just the cost to the fund of being able to retire without penalty. Most of the districts have bargained for the health benefits, and now they're bonding and paying interest on bonds to cover that, to get it to that. So I think that the decision that we have to make is whether we go forward with that additional, and I don't know if deleting the whole section takes away the money that we need from the employer side going into the fund. I think you may have to do a little different approach to the amendment, but I think adding the benefit at this time is really, really hard to defend. And even at that 0.1%, I'm not sure if that covers. It certainly doesn't, I doubt that it covers what the employer is expected to contribute in terms of the health benefits after they have retired and chosen that option.
Sir,
Chairman, Senator Betzel, Mr. Martin, I'm assuming you had an actuarial study done as a result of these changes. What is the most recent actuarial study concerning PRA?
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, yes, we have annual valuations, and the most recent valuation was completed as of the end of the fiscal 2008 year. And the proposal that is before you was also costed out by the actuary, so we know that it is 1.9% of payroll, as I said earlier.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Hacking, was there a projection on when this fund would be back up to 100% funding?
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, yes, that's the problem. We should be on a path to get to 100% funded in approximately 27 years, but we are not on that path. We are deficient and are not contributing. According to the actuarial reports, we're not collecting enough in contributions to be able to be on that path to 100% funded. And that's why this recommendation is before you, is to get the contribution rates up and get us back on that path. And if we are lucky enough to have a good investment period, those rates could actually come down. Some of you have been here a long time, including yourself, may remember when contribution rates for TRA employers was 9%. They were 9% for a very long time. Because we were in this similar situation of poor funding. We got those contributions, they were well invested, the plan got back on its feet, and that 9% rate was dropped to 5 in 1997-98, creating a lot of savings for the system, the state, the employers. So I think we've demonstrated in the past that with good funding and paying attention to these funding issues early gets us back on that path to a point where we could actually give back some resources to the state and to school districts. And unfortunately, because of the market situation, we are back in that situation of needing additional funds, asking for the rate to go from 5.5 to 7.5 gradually over 4 years. And, you know, we're hopeful if we get that money early and can leverage the improvement in the markets that we hope will occur, then those rates can moderate. That's the hope.
Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, so I understand, with the changes that are in this bill, this fund will be back up to 100% in 27 years. Is that correct or not correct?
With the changes in this bill, we would still be somewhat short by about 1% of payroll. But again, we just don't know what the markets are going to do in the next few years. And there is an automatic stabilizer in the bill that says if we still need additional revenue, then employee and employer rates would go up very gradually, 0.25% per year, similar to authority that PARA and MSRS have in their laws right now. So this bill would take us most of the way there by under current projections. We're going to have to reevaluate in 4 to 6 years, depending upon market returns, to see where we are. If things are better than we're predicting, those rates could come down. If they are not as good as we're predicting, then they might have to inch up some more.
Mr. Chairman, what are the actuarial assumptions now? What is the actuarial expected rate of return from the State Board of Investment, and what is the longevity assumption?
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, the assumed rate of return is 8.5% per year for the fund. With respect to longevity, our actuarial tables are pretty much in line with our experience. We made a significant adjustment in 2000 because people were living longer. That adjustment was made in 2000. We've been monitoring it, and we have an experience study that's due very soon, and we don't believe there's going to be any need for additional longevity corrections. But that's kind of a draft at this point, and I can't say for certain, but that's our expectation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Sarah Robin.
And I renew my motion, and I will come back with an amendment for the floor that would deal with the deficiency only and not increased benefits. And I think that, it will save the employee money, it will save the employer money, but the biggest benefit we can provide is having a healthy fund. And I think that everybody, like we said, is worried about retirement today, and I think that having a healthy fund is more important than adding additional benefits right now. And so I would try and do this all on the floor, and take this out and put in a replacement. But this committee now understands this better than we will be able to explain it on the floor, because we have the experts here who have just explained to us how it all works, and we won't have that benefit necessarily when we take this discussion to the floor. So I think it would be easiest to delete this section and then come back with a amendment that would address the deficiency.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I've been accosted or intercepted or assaulted verbally by some elements of my district about how the government is going to be rescuing people with public pensions, but what are they doing about rescuing the rest of our society that have private pensions that are in the tank? And so when Senator Roebling has spoken the last few times, I've been paying close attention to her, and I think it kind of doesn't look right for us to be enhancing public pensions when private pensions are in the tank right now. So maybe it's more appropriate to do what Senator Roebling is talking about and getting the fund in good shape financially, so that it's at least we're on the even keel. And I've long supported public pensions. I think one of the most important benefits we get as a public employee is a pension plan. And the defined benefit plan is quite a benefit that we're lucky we've got it. Most of our fellow citizens don't have that. So I'm not sure the ins and outs of what the amendment should look like. Senator Roebling seems to have some idea on that, but it does seem to me that right now it'd be appropriate to do what we can to restore the fund to financial health, but in terms of enhancing pensions, in light of what is happening in the private sector, I think it is more appropriate than enhancing them, as Senator Betzel's doing.
Sarah Olson.
I wonder if Mr. Watson could tell us if there is if it's too intertwined, or if there is a simple way of, rather than deleting the whole section, of being able to retain that fund protection aspect of it and remove the benefit changes.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, I defer to Senator Betzel, but it looks to me as though on page 98, section 2 is the change in the normal retirement age, and you can just delete that and keep the rest of the bill. It would have the effect of not fully funding the plan in 27 years, but in something less than 27 years. I have no idea how many years sooner that would happen.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Watson, does that take care of the
Sarah Olson.
What I was proposing actually was to increase each contribution from the employee and the employer by 0.25% a year. So instead of going up to 5.5% in 2011, it would go up 5.25%, then to 5.5, then to keep going up by that 0.25%. And so that's what I was proposing to do. So we end up with half of the amount that we would have raised, but it's still coming from both parties. But it should basically take care of the deficiency, because she said that 1.9% is going for the new benefit. And I was looking through here, and I do agree with Mr. Watson that Section 2 would have to be eliminated, but there are a number of other places on page 104. We have to take out the stricken language and take out the new language on page 104 to do that. Then there's probably several more places.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, to eliminate the benefit increases, we would have to eliminate a number of sections. I can rattle them off right now, but it would be sections 2, 8, 9, 15, 16, 17, and 18. So I'll just repeat that again. The benefit increases are in sections 2, 8, 9, 15, 16, 17, 18. Mr. Chair, one and members, and I think Education Minnesota would like to also be heard on that issue too, because the motion is to delete the article. I want to just advise the committee that obviously some members may be looking at the fiscal note and thinking, you know, how can we afford this? And that may weigh into whether or not you support the motion. I have an amendment that would delay the effective date of the employer contributions and basically push the four-year cycle back 1 year, so that would start, instead of starting in fiscal year 12, it would start in fiscal year 13. It is my understanding that just within the budget that we have and have adopted, we can afford to do that. We cannot afford to pay for it as it is right now, of paying $20 million in 12 and $41 in 13, but it's my understanding that we could afford to do that. I just want to alert the committee that that's an option we can look at as you weigh your position on the motion before you.
Senator Berglund.
Senator Betzel, when you say we could afford that, how would it change the fiscal note? And how would we be paying for it?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I have to defer to Mr. Mossman as to how to pay for it. Now, the fiscal note, again, only shows you, 10 and 11 deals with the Minsky issue, which we've already talked about.
Yeah,
12 and 13 are the first 2 years of a four-year cycle. You do not see in the fiscal year note, fiscal years 14 and 15, when the contribution payments are going up, and as I say, I can estimate them to be $70 million in 14 and $15 million, or $94 million in 15. Now, what an amendment that I've got, and you know, we can have it passed out whenever the committee wishes to see it, it basically pushes the whole 4 year back 1 year, so it would start in 13. So what you see under the column fiscal year 12 would now be fiscal year 13, and then 41 would be pushed off after the fiscal note. But how you pay for it, I got to ask our fiscal analyst to help me respond to that one.
Okay, he's working on that.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Because it is my intention to help restore the fund, and since Senator Betzel knew which sections it takes to delete the new benefit, I'd like to amend my motion and move to strike out sections 2, 8, 9, 15, 16, 17, 18, or the changes in those sections, at least some of them might be struck. And then change on the employee contribution and the employer contributions on 105 and 106, I believe is where they are. The figures like on 105.18, where it says 5.5%, change that to 5.25%. The next one where it says 6%, 5.5%. 6.5% would become 5.75%. 7% would become 6%. And 7.5% would become 6.25%. and put those figures in that way for the employer contribution as well. So we'd end up with a 1% increase from the employers and a 1% increase from the employees for a total of 2% increase and no new benefit. Well, that is really my intention.
Senator Bensel?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, just Sarah Roebling, just to be clear, right now they are at 5.5%. So pushing at 5.25% actually goes backwards the wrong way. So we actually need to, you know, and of course, well, anyway.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, if you're on 105, you're making those adjustments for the Duluth Teachers Retirement Association. I think the TRA numbers on page 98.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Duluth.
Maybe it's 99.
Yeah, this is
Minneapolis.
But
yeah, there's several places.
The Senate Council understand what they're doing. Well, and I did misspeak. I was subtracting instead of adding before I started.
Okay, we'll get back to your motion. Ms. Allswager, you wanted to testify?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota. And Education Minnesota, as you know, has been working hard to provide. Our major goal in the past has been to try to get the rule of 90 so that we have equal benefits. But this year, we have taken a dramatically different course, and that is that we wanted to be part of the solution because of the funding situation in TRA. So this would have surprised me a year ago. We have backed off of the rule of 90. And we have decided to go with the benefits as Senator Betzold has explained to you. In the past, too, we have always asked for a match, you know, half employer and half employee contribution for any pension benefit improvements. We're not doing that either. We're saying we're going to pay 100% of the pension benefit improvement, and we will pay part of the deficiency. Pensions is extremely complicated. And while it is very simple to make some assumptions and decisions about amendments, et cetera, I'd like you to think about this. Minnesota can be compared to 34 teacher pension plans in the country because we're coordinated with Social Security. The average employer contribution is 8.5%. So while it's easy to say that the employee should pay more, we need to look at the bigger picture. And that is, I would argue, Education Minnesota would argue, that the employer has not been stepping up to the point that they should. I could probably say that if since the mid-90s, when the employer rate went from 6.5 to 5.0, that had we even had those contributions over the years, we would not have the deficiency, possibly. I can't say 100%. But when our employer contribution is one of the lowest in the country, employer, and the average is 8.5, I think there are other questions to ask about how to fix the fund. In addition, when you look at the employee contribution in those 34 states, we are above average. So we would strongly oppose this amendment because comparing Minnesota to the other states, we are way out of whack. And we would suggest that if I wanted to get something passed, I have to go this route. But what we really think should happen is it should be the employer contribution if we want to be average. We're not asking for that. Education Minnesota is trying to be part of the solution because, number one, we want a stable fund. And number two, we want to provide some benefit equity to our members, but we are not asking for the rule of 90 politically. We know it's not going to happen in today's situation. So we would ask you to oppose the amendment. We would ask you to support this solution.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I understood the testimony, you are saying that the teachers are paying for all of the benefit increase and part of the deficiency. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, that is correct.
Mr. Chair.
Well, if that's the case, I may have to change my mind on this, but I'd like to hear what Senator Roebling has to say.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
What I heard is they're paying for 0.1%, one-tenth of a percent of the deficiency, and the other 1.9% will be going toward the benefit. That isn't a very big contribution. to the deficiency.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just would like to know, if you leave this in, how to pay for it. Because I don't want somebody coming in, you know, in 2012 and telling me I have to cut a group home wages when they're only making $10 an hour. Pay for them. That's my concern.
Okay, we have Senator Roebling's motion in front of us. Is there further discussion on Senator Roebling's amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Watson.
Could I clarify what the amendment is? The first part, I think, is relatively clear, deleting sections 2, 8, 9, 15, 16, 17, and 18. But the second part, the 0.25% increase, can you go over that again? Is that part of this motion, or is that a separate motion?
I would try and make that part of the motion. Senator Russell,
I can
help.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, if you look on page 98, from lines 98.4, 98.5, 98.6, 98.7, okay, that is the aid increase. So in order to get it, you'd have to drop that from the 0.5%, I think, down to 0.25 in order to make that part work.
And the teacher composition.
And Senator Betzel,
yep.
Would we have to also change the table starting on 98.26? Drop each one of those a quarter.
Okay. Mr. Mossman? Mr. Mossman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, you would change the table starting on 98.26. You would change the table starting on
105?
Yeah, on line 20, I'm sorry, line 29. You change the table starting on line 99.28. You would change the table starting on line 100.12. I said that. And I think you'd also have the table on 105.18.
Senator Berglund.
A couple of comments, Mr. Chair and members. Relative to cutting the rates in half and Senator Roebling's motion and the fiscal note that you have in front of you, I think the way to think about that is that the aid payment changes to school districts, the numbers in the fiscal note would be cut in half. So it would be half of these amounts, so that in the first year it would be roughly $10.3 million, moving to roughly $42 million by the fourth year. So that in year four and after, it would be a $41 million cost rather than an $82 million cost each year. And to Senator Berglund's question, these costs have not been included in any Senate targets in building Senate budgets. So I think to your point, it would be funded, it would have to be funded outside of those amounts. Currently in the Senate position, taking into account the full Senate tax bill that's now in conference committee, there were resources, as you recall from a previous meeting here, that were dropped to the bottom line. The current Senate position for all of the legislation it's passed is a positive balance of $60 million even in fiscal 13. That would not leave enough resources to cover the entire bill as it is before the committee, unamended. It would leave you the options, some of them that were described by Senator Betzel earlier, and in addition to delaying the impact year, it would accommodate reducing the rates in half. It would accommodate either of those. positions, and that would, again, then, you know, in terms of funding it and keeping the tails balanced in the Senate position, assumes adoption of the Senate tax bill and other provisions that accommodated that money.
Mr. Watson.
Again, to clarify, Mr. Mossman, the table is on page 106 for Duluth and St. Paul. Did you mention those also?
Mr. Chair, members, no, I missed 106. I believe it would change. It would essentially change all the tables.
Change all the tables.
In Article 6 would be, the rates would be, rate increases from year to year would be reduced in half.
All right. Sir Berlin.
So is anybody supporting the idea that the districts would absorb it, absorb these costs, as
absorb the cost?
Had suggested?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, as I laid out a couple of options. And the School Boards Association is here. They testified to the Pension Commission that they were conditionally supporting this, provided that they got assistance as levy authority, or, you know, possibly some funding in here. I think if the bill was just be structured saying just raise the employer increases, and you figure out how to pay for it. I think I'm fairly certain that they'd oppose, you know, having anything done here, because they wouldn't have funds within their budgets to do it. But they're here, so they can testify as well too.
Yeah. Well, we have Senator Roebling's motion in front of us. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, it included the removal of the change of benefits plus the reduction of
That is what I'm hoping we're doing with these proposals, yes.
So Mr. Chairman, were you increasing the employee contribution even without the benefit?
That's correct. The benefit is healthy fund.
Okay. We have the motion in front of us. Is there further discussion on the motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion fails.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A2 amendment. Mr. Chair, members, as the A2 amendment is being distributed, I'll describe it. You can see just it's a series of years, 2012 to 2013, 2014 to 2015, 2015 to 2016. As I described earlier, the fiscal note as we have it cannot be paid for with the resources we have, as Mr. Mossman described. However, what this would propose to do would be to move back the state contributions. It'd be from the four-year block, move everything back 1 year. This does not affect the employee, the teacher contributions. They would still have to make their contributions on schedule, so they would in effect be paying their part of it before the state contributions kick in with a one-year delay. We have actually spent a bit of time trying to figure out what is the effect of delaying the state contributions, and frankly, it could make the hole bigger by delaying. We looked at what's the options of pushing back 1 year, 2 years, and so forth. The longer you delay, the bigger the problem could be down the road. But if we're trying to balance in the out years, the A2 amendment within the budget targets that we have within the Senate can be accomplished with the A2 amendment.
Okay, we have Senator Betzold's A2 amendment in front of us.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Chairman and Senator Betzold, when you say that we could pay for this in the out years with the Senate targets that we have for fiscal year 12-13, what do you mean?
Mr. Chair, if we're trying to balance the budget for 12 and 13, if you delay the effective date to move the cost of fiscal 12 into fiscal year 13, and then fiscal year 13 into 14. The only thing we would be looking at is balancing the budget for 12 and 13 with this $20 million cost. As Mr. Mossman said, and as I understood it, the overall set of budget that we have right now could absorb that. It could not absorb paying for it under the fiscal note of $20 million in 12 and $41 million in 13. That's as I understood.
Sir Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzel, we have no idea that we have the money in 2014.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, that would be pushing it out. The following biennium, I have no idea what that would look like.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bitzel, you are moving just the dates, extending the dates for the employer contribution. You're leaving the employee contribution and the benefits in place as it starts.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, yes. This simply puts the four-year block of state contributions to help pay for the employer contributions and moves everything back 1 year. It does not affect the effective dates of the employee contributions. They would still start kicking in with their increased contributions on schedule, which I believe would be starting in 12.
Sir?
So, Mr. Chairman, we're increasing the benefits and the use of that fund without stabilizing and filling in the gaps right now.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, the employees, well, first of all, they're going to be paying into it right now. They're not going to be starting to draw on the benefits in 12 and 13. I mean, if we're talking about somebody who's got to work 30 years to get the benefit of this, we're talking mainly about people hired after July 1st of 1989 who did not qualify for the rule of 90. They're going to have to, if they work 30 years, that puts you to, what is it, 2019 before they even qualify. So that would be a few years out. They start to be paying now, but they can't start getting their benefits for a couple of years anyway.
Sir Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know Senator Pogomiller has made a big issue of having balanced budgets in the out years. But, you know, by pushing this out even further, we're making, and I'll support it because I know the districts would be in better shape if it's out a little further. But we're supporting something, a whole package. I still am opposing the whole package that we don't know that we can pay for. And that we pretty much can be assured is going to come out of the hides of the schools and the kids who attend them. And I'm just so troubled by this. I can't understand adding this type of benefit when we have no money.
All right, we have Senator Betzel's A2 amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion? Not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. If there are further amendments, we only have a few minutes left to commit.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Metzl.
I have an amendment that I think is, there's no cost to it. It was brought to me from Senator Lynch, and I believe she's talked to Senator Betzel about it, and I think it's all right to do it. Passed on the floor, on the Senate floor, and Senate Bill number 3, but we're a little worried about that bill might not make it. So if I could have just about 30 seconds with Jason George, he's with the International Union of Operating Engineers out of the Rochester area. And again, Senator Lynch, I believe, has visited with the author. And I don't.
Mr. Chair,
this issue gets done.
This is a bill that's actually been moving through the system, and it is consistent with things that have been done in the pension bills in the past. I've reviewed it, and Mr. Martin has reviewed it as well, too. We do have somebody from the affected union who can testify very briefly on it, but. I don't think there's a problem in adopting it.
Would you like to testify?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jason George. I'm with the Operating Engineers, Local 49. This language simply clarifies current practice. There was an Attorney General's, a Deputy Attorney General's opinion that came down last fall. They called into question we have public employees in our private Taft-Hartley fund, and we've been doing it for 20 years, and it's current practice. What number of unions do it? And there was some question about it in statute as it was written. This just clarifies that expressly clarifies that is current practice is legal. So it's just comfort language for the counties. They support it, so do the cities.
Is there further discussion on the A3 amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Further discussion on the bill, Senator Tomasoni.
Chairman, I have A1.
Thanks, Locke.
Mr. Chairman, while it's come to us going around in Florida, this was in the pension bill last year, so we had a discussion. We moved on to the Senate floor. And to give you a little bit of background on it, what this is state employees who are in the unclassified plan, everybody comes in the unclassified plan, after they've been in the state service for 10 years, have the ability to opt for the general plan or the unclassified plan as their retirement plan, except for legislators. Legislators can't do that. So any legislator that was elected after 1996, and this table probably doesn't have a lot of them around here, have the ability to, when they retire, to opt for either the general plan retirement or the unclassified plan retirement. And given what's been happening in the economy, the unclassified plan hasn't been that attractive these days. In addition, since we don't get any pay raises ever, the amount of money that's going into the plan for the legislators has been reduced significantly also. So it's one of these fairness things, whether or not everybody that's a state employee should be allowed to opt for one plan or the other, and if the legislators can. So basically what this amendment does is says that if you've been in the legislature for 10 years and you happen to be in the legislature for 10 years, so there's a lot of people that doesn't apply to you, you can opt for one plan or the other.
Mr. Chair, we had some discussion on this in the past. This is a policy issue, but it's also there's some political implications in here too, and I hope legislators pay close attention to what this amendment does, because I think Senator Cohen can very well talk about what happens when legislative pension issues become part of a political campaign. I think he lost his election, I think, over that issue.
Well, there were many, many reasons.
Well, but that was one. But that was one.
Door knock at the door.
Well, yeah. But basically what happens is, you know, there's the legislators who were elected prior to 96 were put in an old legislator's plan. Those elected afterwards become the part of the MSRS plan, which other state employees are in. Although I was elected in 92, I opted to go into the MSRS plan, so we had that option available to us. Just a brief description of what this can do. People who are in the old legislator's plan, they had the opportunity to go and take another job and take all their years of government service and apply them to their next job. I have a lot of respect for Tom Neville as a legislator and as a judge. He never planned it this way, but here's how it worked out to his benefit. When he became a judge, he was able to take his 18 years or so as a legislator and apply them to his judicial pension, as though he had been a judge since 1990. When Steve Swigum retired from the House of Representatives and became a commissioner, he could take his years of service in the House and apply them as though he had been a commissioner all those years, when in fact that wasn't the case. But that's just how it worked. When the law was changed for legislators, we were put into the unclassified service. The unclassified service was intended for people who are going to be in government for a period of time, but maybe some not long enough to actually get a real pension out of it. We're not the type of the worker bees that are going to be here for years and years and years. Some people are, some people are not. But because of some political sensitivities, our employees, our legislative assistants, they can work for the legislature for 10 years, and they can move on to another government job and take the credit that they had in the legislature, as long as they've been here for 10 years, and move that into another pension. presumably, but, you know, many of them, they may get a comparable job, or maybe people who, for instance, worked for the House of Representatives and worked over now to the governor's office, maybe they can get an enhanced benefit. I mean, it varies. Legislators and elected officials, like the constitutional officers, cannot take your 10 years of service and move that into another job. This is basically what it would allow us to do. You know, and there you have to be very careful and understand the ramifications of doing that. It basically, you know, we could be open to saying we are doing this to improve our own pensions when we get out of the legislature. So understand that that is the implications of the A1 amendment, and that's all I have to say on it.
Sure. Sir, that's it.
What's the problem with that? I mean, if you're a public servant, then you move on to be a public servant a little later.
Well, and the fact
I think that's good. Yeah, I mean, well, you're still in the system. You're working for the people, and I don't see a problem with that.
The problem is, and again, this could be more of a political problem than a policy problem, is the fact that as legislators, you know, we know our pay is not even close to what every study has said we should be getting. If you are fortunate enough to move out of the legislative process and get another state government job and are able to apply your years of service in the legislature, it again is just like you have been in that job from day one instead of being here in the legislature, and that can cause, you know, as I say, it's a political issue more than anything else. Be aware of what is here.
If you don't move to another public job, and you just retire as a legislator, you're the only state employee that can opt for either the general plan or the classified plan. Every other state employee can opt for either a general plan retirement or a state plan or a classified plan retirement. So we're being treated way differently than all other state employees as a result. And this is just a fairness thing as far as I'm concerned.
We have the A1 amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion?
I just want to make one comment. I mentioned Judge Neville. He was surprised when he found out that was the impact of it. He was shocked. But, I mean, he couldn't change it. In fact, even if he wanted, he couldn't have changed it. So he didn't do anything wrong or untoward. That's just how the system worked. You know.
Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know what the difference is between the general and the classified. What were you describing, that Senator Neville? Is that the classified plan?
No.
Is that the general plan?
The general plan is a high plan.
That's the legislator's plan now.
Yeah. Well, if you're elected before 96, you're elected after 96.
What about those of us who are elected in 96?
You qualify for this.
Do you have an amendment?
Representative Trumbull was the first person affected by the change because there was a transition period in there. When her husband died and she was elected in special election, she was the very first person. Everybody after Representative Trumbull was affected. Maybe Mr. Martin could describe the difference.
For the
MSRS plan.
Mr. Martin.
Members, very quickly, I'm Larry Martin from the Pension Commission staff. The unclassified plan is a defined contribution benefit, so the value of your account in that plan is the benefit. The general plan of the state retirement system is a formula plan, a defined benefit plan. Years of service based on a high five, certain benefit accrual rate gives you your ultimate benefit.
Which is which now?
The unclassified plan is a defined contribution plan, an IRA type plan.
That's The unclassified plan.
Yeah. The MSRS general plan is a defined benefit plan, a formula plan.
Mr. Chairman? I should know this. We haven't really discussed this since I've been on the Pension Commission, so I never did understand it. Because we talked about the legislator's plan and the MSRS plan. Now you're talking about the classified and the unclassified. And I think Senator Olson is confused as I am about what is what
the
and what each means.
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
maybe we should go talk
Senator
about
Pappas.
Retirement benefits.
The legislator's plan was a unique plan for legislators only, but basically, in this plan I believe that you would be in, your benefit is defined by the number of years of service and the pay that you got. So your high five is going to define how long you served. Is going to define what your legislative pension is, and it's not tied into Social Security or anything. Those in the MSRS plan, the unclassified plan, is a contribution plan. So I'm in that plan. I opted to go over. I contribute, and the employer contributes, and what my benefit is going to get is not based upon obviously, the number of years I serve is going to matter because I keep contributing every year that I'm here. But it isn't like high five. It is a contribution. It is fun in the stock market. Now, by the way, because the stock market has been going down, when I get my monthly, my regular statements from MSRS, my pension has been going down for my because as a defined contribution thing, if we had a favorable stock market, that improves my pension. Bad stock market, it goes down, but it's got nothing to do with tied into my pay as a legislator. I contribute towards it, and that is the difference. Now, under this proposal, you could move into a position where it would be defined as high five. So you could get many years in the legislative service, get to a new, like if I became a judge, as an example, under this provision, if this were to become law, then I could do the same thing as Senator Neville. Transfer it over. I could not do this right now because I'm not allowed to take my service in the legislature and transfer it over into a higher paying government position. So I couldn't do that under Senator Tomasoni's thing. People who are in the MSRS, either because they're elected or they opted to go into it, would then be able to use their legislative service and go into a higher paying position and get the full credit for that.
Okay, we're going to have to finish within a couple of minutes, but Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, is it true that if you're in a defined benefit plan, that's the ones that can transfer? That's what the, if you're in a defined contribution plan, you can.
Defined benefit is portable. Yes. Yeah, you can move it around.
That's
yes.
What, okay, thank you.
Okay, we have Senator Tomasoni's A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I don't have anything further. So if there's nothing further, I would move that Senate File 191 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a comment. And I apologize. I had to leave for part of our discussion on the Article 6. And I'm not sure even of the exact resolution of it, but it seems to me that we're having an additional cost that we're voting out in some delegates that we don't have a way to pay for. And those are some of the very arguments that we use to try to put our Senate budget together is how we balance our budget in those out years. And those are the very arguments I used in our conference committee when the House brought in a proposal that included about $2.5 billion per year when it was phased in. $1 billion per year and no revenues to pay for it. And it's one thing to have when you have revenues. And I had thought about in the House's proposal that maybe if we would say, okay, if there's a balanced budget, if the shifts were paid back, and if there were new revenues, we might be able to go ahead with that. But even with that, it would continue to be a very competitive disadvantage for other areas of spending. And it certainly isn't that I don't want to see more revenues put into education funding. I don't think that's true at all. But I think the commitments that you make in the pension area become solid commitments that are more difficult to change. Once you make those commitments that you're going to put in, 20, 40, $100 million, it's very difficult to back out of it. And so it becomes doubly difficult, I think, to do that and not have some source of revenues. And I don't know what the answer is. Maybe you could, the ones that you mentioned, Senator Betzel, like levies or some other way, at least it's real money. And I think by just extending or pushing out a date, it becomes we're not dealing with real money, we're dealing with creating more friction and more uncertainty, I think.
Well, Senator Stumpf, I know you had to leave. Senator Romney had an amendment that dealt with that.
We should bring your Leroy.
Unless we offer to pass that. Obviously, Senator Bessel and I have talked about this, and you know, periodically in a legislative session we deal with play money. This isn't play money. I mean, this is, the way this is structured, this is real money at some point in the future.